You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, takes on the world news.
This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. At 0 hour in Damascus this coming Saturday morning, a complicated agreement negotiated between Secretary of State John Kerry and Russian Federation Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, calling for a cessation of hostilities between Syria's warring parties, those that are not on the international terrorist list, is scheduled to go into effect. The news of this received short shrift on NPR's Morning Edition, as it did from the New York Times and other elements of the mainstream media, who have adopted the neocons version of the Middle East as smoothly as they did in the run-up to the Iraq War and with coverage of the U.S.-sponsored coup in Iran and Ukraine. Given the tensions between Russia and the United States over Ukraine, it seemed unlikely that the two sides would produce an agreement with almost all the warring parties in Syria that, instead of fighting each other, will focus on defeating the two UN-designated terrorist organizations, the Islamic State, or Daesh, and Jabhat al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria, which previously has enjoyed White House backing, as well as that of the Saudis and Turkey. The agreement will not be welcomed and is likely to be sabotaged by Turkey and Saudi Arabia, two rogue states that are less concerned with defeating the Islamic State, with which both have collaborated, than overthrowing Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. I had hoped to speak at 20 minutes past the hour with Charles Glass, ABC Middle East correspondent, who is visiting New York from his home in Britain, but we seem to have had a problem with his cell phone number. So unless he calls in, we'll be asking you for your takes on the world. Well, one of the things I hope to discuss was a recent article he had in Harper's called Disunited Front, the chaotic, underfunded battle against the Islamic State, and get his take on how Monday's agreement may change the current situation. But it looks like we won't get that. Well, in war, truth is the first casualty, or so wrote, we are told, Aeschylus, a Greek dramatist who lived in the 5th century BC. But all evidence suggests the facts meeting an untimely end well before the first shot is fired. The lies that justified the war in Iraq were years in fabrication. Those told about Iran have also been years in the making. If you've watched the debates, both Republican and Democrat, you've heard them repeated as if they were part of a catechism obligatory for the presidential candidates of both parties. The mainstream media does the same, never bothering to provide the evidence against Hezbollah, that much maligned Shia political party and militia that came into existence in response to Israel's invasion of Lebanon in 1982 and after 18 years of struggle finally forced Israel to withdraw its troops in 2000. That invasion was a genuine example of state terror for which Israel, with unconditional U.S. backing, has become infamous in the region. The mainstream media provided a rare moment of truth regarding Syria last Friday when the Boston Globe published an article by Stephen Kinzer, whose reporting on U.S. misadventurism in Central America for the New York Times in the 80s is one of American journalism's finest moments. In the Globe article under the headline, "The Media Are Misleading the Public on Syria," Kinzer wrote, "Coverage of the Syrian war will be remembered as one of the most shameful episodes in the history of American press. Reporting about carnage in the ancient city of Aleppo is the latest reason why. For 3 years, violent militants have run Aleppo," writes Kinzer. "Their rule began with a wave of repression. They posted notices warning residents, quote, don't send your children to school. If you do, we will get the backpack and you will get the coffin," end quote. Then they destroyed factories, hoping that unemployed workers would have no recourse other than to become fighters. They trucked looted machinery to Turkey and sold it. This month, people in Aleppo have finally seen glimmers of hope. The Syrian army and its allies have been pushing militants out of the city. Last week, noted Kinzer, they reclaimed the main power plant. Regular electricity may soon be restored. The militants' hold on the city could be ending. Militants true to form, Kinzer Right, are wreaking havoc as they are pushed out of the city by Russian and Syrian army forces. Turkish-Saudi-backed moderate rebels shower the residential neighborhoods of Aleppo with unguided rockets and gas jars, one Aleppo resident wrote on social media. The Beirut-based analyst Marwa Osma asked, quote, "The Syrian Arab army, which is led by President Bashar Assad, is the only force on the ground, along with their allies who are fighting ISIS. So you want to weaken the only system that is fighting ISIS?" Well, that does not fit with Washington's narrative, points out Kinzer. As a result, much of the American press is reporting the opposite of what is actually happening. Like you hear today from Alice Fordham in Istanbul, she's getting her information, as she admits, from those fighting the government. She's not there on the ground. Many news reports, writes Kinzer, suggest that Aleppo has been, quote, a liberated zone for 3 years, but now is being pulled back into misery. Americans are being told, writes Kinzer, that the virtuous course in Syria is to fight the Assad regime and its Russian and Iranian partners. We are supposed to hope that a righteous coalition of Americans, Turks, Saudis, Kurds, and the moderate opposition will win. This is convoluted nonsense, but Americans cannot be blamed for believing it. We have almost no real information about the combatants, says Kinzer, their goals or their tactics. Much blame for this lies with our media. Under intense financial pressure, he explains, most American newspapers, magazines, and broadcast networks have drastically reduced their core of foreign correspondents. Much important news about the world now comes from reporters based in Washington. In that environment, access and credibility depend on acceptance of official paradigms. Reporters who cover Syria check with the Pentagon, the State Department, the White House, and think tank experts. After a spin on that soil carousel, Kinzer points out, in the Boston Globe, they feel they have covered all sides of the story. This form of stenography produces a pabulum that passes for news about Syria, end quote, but not on Takes on the World. If you want more proof that what is generally referred to as the Israel lobby is pulling the strings of legislators at every political level in the United States, an article distributed by the Jewish Telegraphic Agency yesterday that pointed out that 21 states, nearly half the country, are considering legislation aimed at countering the boycott, divestment, and sanctions, or BDS movement. The article acknowledges that the critics who say some bills are cause for concern, either because they seek to legitimize Israeli settlements or go so far to punish boycott supporters that they infringe on constitutionally protected speech. Two state legislatures from Illinois and South Carolina last year passed laws mandating that their states divest from companies that boycott Israel. Now, according to the article, 11 additional states, Arizona, California, Colorado, Florida, Georgia, Indiana, Iowa, Massachusetts, New Jersey, New York, and Virginia are considering similar laws. Kansas and Pennsylvania are going further, debating legislation that would defund universities that participate in an Israeli boycott. And another six states are considering or have adopted non-binding resolutions condemning Israel boycotts. Proponents say the trend will intensify this year as pro-Israel activists move to consolidate their gains by pushing laws in states that have already passed non-binding resolutions condemning BDS. Those states see what they're doing now as a follow-up, as a successor, said Eugene Kantorovich, a law professor at Northwestern University who has consulted with groups advancing anti-BDS legislation. In a statement that can only be described as standing the truth and justice on their heads, Kantorovich added that, quote, they're implementing laws that use state contracting power to fight back against racism, end quote. I guess that's when it's being done by Israel and supporters against Palestinian Arabs. It's okay. Critics of the anti-boycott legislation describe the push as a stealth maneuver to reverse nearly 50 years of U.S. policy of not recognizing the legitimacy of Israeli settlements. The article quotes Americans for Peace Now, the U.S. affiliate of Israel's Peace Now, as saying that 19 of the anti-BDS laws that have been proposed since 2014 extend penalties to those targeting only West Bank settlements. A bill adopted by the Indiana House of Representatives in January, for example, requires a state pension fund to divest from companies that participate in a boycott of businesses based in Israel or territories controlled by the Jewish State of Israel, end quote. Not surprisingly, the bill from New York, one of Israel's most important occupied territories, adopted by its state senate in January and scheduled for a third reading in assembly, extends protections to Israeli settlements. Moreover, the bill requires, on the taxpayer's dime, that the state make a list of persons deemed to be engaging in a boycott who would then be rendered ineligible to do business with the state of New York. Meanwhile, Occupy Washington, President Obama reportedly is expected to sign the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP, a trade agreement with the European Union in which agents of Israel and Congress inserted a provision that contravenes longtime U.S. policy by recognizing the West Bank Jewish-only settlements as being part of Israel. As passed by Congress, the U.S. will punish any European company that boycotts products produced in the settlements which the UN and most of the nations, including the United States, consider to be illegal. In London last week, Prime Minister David Cameron's government, hoping to stem the growth of the boycott sanctions and investment movement there, made it illegal for any government-funded institution to engage in any anti-Israel activities. Monday, he had his response. According to the Times of Israel, the story was ignored here, of course, millions of Londoners were exposed to a series of anti-Israel posters on the underground network to mark the beginning of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement's 12th annual Israel Apartheid Week. The Jewish Chronicle in Britain quoted Transport for London, which is responsible for what the Brits refer to as the tube service, as saying this was, quote, an act of vandalism, end quote, that the ads were not authorized and staff members were working to take them down. The posters, designed in the style of BBC reports, attacked the UK Broadcasting Service for biased pro-Israel reporting and claimed Israel used British arms to, quote, massacre Palestinians during 2014 Operation Protective Edge in Gaza. A third poster criticized the global security company G4S for working in Israel, while a fourth, titled Apartheid is Great Britain, alleged that more than 100 UK companies continue to supply military equipment to the Jewish state. The Jewish Chronicle estimated that the ads appeared in some 500 trains. You rarely, if ever, read about these events in the U.S. mainstream media or hear about them on CNN, Fox News, MSNBC, or NPR, such news being limited, it seems, to the Israeli and American Jewish media. So unless you're plugged into that, you'll be unaware that a large multi-day joint exercise between the Israel Defense Forces and the U.S. European Command officially got underway on Sunday. According to the IDF spokesman's unit, as reported by the Jewish News Service, the goal of the exercise, named Juniper Cobra 16, is to improve cooperation and coordination between the two militaries and bolster ballistic missile defense capabilities, end quote. More than 1,700 U.S. soldiers, civilians, and contractors traveled to Israel to take part in the exercise. Juniper Cobra exercises are held every 2 years, and this year's marks the eighth since the first one was held in 2001. During the current exercise, the American and Israeli participants are training via computer simulations on how to deal with missile and rocket attacks. The various components of Israel's multi-tiered aerial defense network, paid for by American taxpayers, including the Iron Dome, David Sling, and Arrow systems, are part of the exercise. According to the Israel spokesperson's unit, that's right, they have a special unit trained in official speak, this exercise provides an opportunity for both militaries for joint learning and training. The exercise is another step in strategic relations between Israel and the U.S., and it will greatly contribute to regional stability, unquote. Contributing to regional stability, the U.S. or Israel? Who is he or she kidding? They apparently have to put such ludicrous statements on paper, since no one, even an Israeli spokesperson steeped in lying, could repeat such nonsense with a straight face. And needless to say, despite all these joint exercises, not a single Israeli soldier has participated in any U.S. military action in the Middle East. Well, it rated only filler space in the New York Times international section and nothing at all in NPR. But a week ago Tuesday, Washington's puppet prime minister in Ukraine, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, barely survived a no-confidence vote in the country's parliament following what Newsweek described as a, quote, a harrowing assessment of his term in office by Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko. Poroshenko, whose party rules in coalition with Yatsenyuk's party, issued a statement claiming that 70% of the population had lost faith in the Yatsenyuk government and, quote, a full reboot was necessary. Lawmakers took turns taking shots at Yatsenyuk's record, accusing him of corruption, failed economic policies, and inability to complete promised projects such as a planned $225 million wall on the Russian border. Maybe you should contact Donald Trump for that one. Anyway, listen to my last program. We'll recall that Yatsenyuk was the choice of U.S. Deputy Secretary of State and former Hillary Clinton press spokesperson Victoria Nuland Kagan to lead the new pro-American Ukrainian government after last year's coup, and that I played a recording of Nuland Kagan telling a group of Ukrainian-American businessmen that Washington had spent $5 billion trying to overthrow the then-current Ukrainian government. Finally, I feel the need to say a word about the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, who has been widely hailed as, quote, a towering figure, unquote, in the 30 years he served on the nation's highest court. Even President Obama, whose right to appoint a successor mandated by the Constitution, is being challenged by the leadership of the Republicans in the Senate and the GOP's gaggle of presidential candidates referred to Scalia as towering. Curious, when it should have been clear from Scalia's strict interpretation of the Constitution that he considers Obama and African-American to be only three-fifths of a man, and that, like the country's founders, only for the purposes of a census and not as someone qualified to vote. An exaggeration? An unfair criticism of someone described as one of the court's legal minds, greatest legal minds? Not at all. His leading the court and overturning the landmark piece of civil rights legislation, the 1965 Voting Rights Act in 2013, after it had been renewed by overwhelming margins in both the Senate and the House, was the act of a white supremacist, a white racist, which Scalia was. In arguing against the legitimacy of the act, Scalia warned against, quote, a phenomenon that's called perpetuation of racial entitlement. It's been written about, he said. Whenever a society adopts racial entitlements, it is very difficult, said Scalia, to get out of them through the normal political processes. And I am fairly confident it will be reenacted in perpetuity unless, said Scalia, a court can say it does not comport with the Constitution. And so the Supreme Court, under the thumb of Scalia, did just that by a 5-4 decision, without acknowledging that the primary example of a society adopting racial entitlements to its detriment was our very own, and it was enshrined in our Constitution for all the world to see, but most of whom have forgotten. This is Jeff Blankford. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Week in Palestine.
طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح طفلة تمتطي.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is John Roberts. This week we are pleased to feature a presentation by Anna Bolzer, who is, among other things, an organizer for the U.S. campaign to end the occupation, and in that capacity has her finger on the pulse of organizing all over the country. Here she speaks at a peace action conference in Minneapolis, Minnesota, that took place in November of 2014. It is, among other things, a wonderful rundown of the status of the BDS campaign. But beyond that, she also offers some sage advice to all who are organizing around the BDS campaign and pro-Palestinian effort across the country. The presentation begins with her introduction. Here is Anna Bolzer of the U.S. campaign to end the occupation.
I'd like to call Anna Bolzer to the front. I've known of Anna for a number of years and always been impressed by her work and her presence. And I would like to tell you a few things about her. She's a Jewish American public speaker, author, and activist for Palestinian human rights. At the present time, she is also the national organizer for the U.S. campaign to end the occupation. After graduating from Columbia University, she traveled to the Middle East in 2003 on a Fulbright grant to teach English in Ankara, Turkey. Since then, she has traveled to the West Bank as a volunteer for the International Women's Peace Service to document human rights abuses and support nonviolence resistance. Her publications have documented 8 months of human conditions while on assignment in the West Bank. Today, we are most grateful to have her present with us as she shares more of her experiences with Palestinians and maybe a little bit about the Fourth Precinct. We'll see. So welcome, Anna.
So thank you to Sabil and all the organizers for making this event happen, and thank you everyone for being here, especially at 1:30 on a Friday afternoon. I know it's not easy for everybody, so thanks for being here. It's an honor and privilege to talk to you. I'm excited to be able to open up this conference with some commentary on the really amazing, extraordinary place that the state of the U.S. movement for Palestine is at today. I'm actually not going to be, the title of my talk is State of the U.S. Movement for Justice in Palestine, Building Power Through BDS and Joint Struggle. So that's actually going to be the focus of what I'm talking about. I've presented here in Minneapolis several times and the Twin Cities and nearby. I think I was here first in 2006 and then again in 2008, and I was just sort of reflecting on how much has changed really since last time I presented here in 2008, how the situation on the ground continues to deteriorate, and I think we'll be learning about that throughout the weekend, but also the movement for justice in Palestine has achieved milestones that I think were once unimaginable, and were even unimaginable in 2008 when I was last here, so it's really kind of extraordinary to reflect on how much has changed, and I want to comment a bit on that. And I hope this weekend can be a time for both deepening our understanding of the injustices in Palestine, but also committing together to working for justice effectively with clear principles. I called my talk State of the U.S. Movement for Justice in Palestine, knowing, of course, that I cannot possibly give you a comprehensive talk on everything about this movement because it is so big and widespread, and no one person even can keep track of it, let alone cover it in a one-hour talk. But I'll focus on two things that I think really show where this movement, how far this movement has come, and the power that has been built on a national and local scale to really start to challenge mainstream institutions and the dominant narrative in this country. It is difficult to overstate the significance of the Palestinian call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, a call made to us people around the world acting in solidarity, the way that this call has transformed the solidarity movement for justice in Palestine, putting agency back into the hands of people of conscience, with the Palestinian themselves as our center of accountability. So I want to start by talking about the way that BDS has worked, how it can continue working, and maybe give some concrete ideas, and then shift into talking a bit about joint struggle and intersectional work and how that has also enhanced this movement. So 10 years ago, Palestinian civil society issued a historic call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, similar to those used against apartheid South Africa, targeting Israel and institutional participation in its oppressive regime. And BDS comes in many shapes and sizes, and if we get the PowerPoint up, I can give you some examples of some of the really creative ways in which BDS is playing out around the country and just how widespread it is. But there are boycotts of Israeli goods and other products that are and services that are linked to Israeli apartheid. There's a boycott of Israeli academic and cultural institutions, which are part and parcel, of course, of Israel's military occupation. There is divestment by institutions like churches, like campuses, universities, municipalities, pension funds, banks, foundations, etc., in choosing to stop investing in companies involved in Israeli aggression. And there are other forms of BDS, including, of course, eventually getting to the S, sanctions, whereby the U.S. government and governments around the world will impose sanctions on Israel to make it no longer able to continue its oppression of Palestinians. And the goals of the BDS movement are the fulfillment of the basic human rights of the different parts of the Palestinian community and society, according to international law. These are uncontroversial rights and goals, namely, one, an end to the 1967 occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, two, equality for 48 Palestinians or Palestinian citizens inside Israel who live as second or third or fourth class citizens, denied the same rights granted to Jews in a Jewish state, and three, of course, the right of return for Palestinian refugees who are living in exile, who are the majority of the Palestinian population. BDS aims for these three basic rights, which are basic conditions of any just and lasting peace. But I want to talk most about BDS the way that I see it, which is as an incredible gift. Many of us were sympathetic with the Palestinian plight for many years. I can remember just how many film screenings we tried to do, speaking events, etc., and people wouldn't come, or it was always the same people who came, right? Vigils with always the same people, feeling like we're not getting anywhere, writing letters to Congress and getting back either no response or something comically terrible in response. There was a time that I remember, even, and for people who've been doing this work for decades longer than myself, I'm sure you have even more examples, when I think a lot of solidarity activists, we were asking ourselves, what does it mean to work in solidarity with the Palestinian people, who are, of course, the leaders and primary agents of their own freedom struggle? And how can we actually affect change? And BDS has helped us answer this question, helping us see our specific role as solidarity activists, and it's also given us an extraordinary tool to build our power, and that's what we see playing out today in this country. And we have lots of evidence of it that I can talk about, and other speakers will be talking about as well, beginning to influence real change. BDS has moved people from sympathy to concrete, effective action in the form of campaigns, guiding all of us to investigate the ways in which we ourselves are implicated in Israel's oppressive systems and to work to end that complicity. Because put simply, BDS is about ending our complicity and our collective compliance with Israeli apartheid. So every person in this room is implicated in multiple ways in Israeli aggression. And it is your job, it is our job, to investigate, to find out how, and to work to end that complicity. That's what BDS is really at its core. And it's not something heroic. Palestinians are not asking of us something heroic to end our harm. It's a basic moral obligation. And by demanding that we end our participation in Israel's war crimes, BDS is doing two things. First, It holds us accountable, as it should. But more importantly, it's giving us back our power. We are no longer waiting for President Obama or the U.S. Congress, or certainly not the Israeli government, to make change, because we are forcing that change ourselves with leadership from the Palestinian people themselves. And while the opposition will characterize BDS as nefarious and scary, we know, and violent even, terrorism even, they say they call it, we know that BDS is a nonviolent tool to address the extreme brutality and violence of Israel's occupation and apartheid policies. BDS utilizes well-tested, time-honored tactics in the legacy of the South African anti-apartheid movement and other anti-colonial, anti-racist freedom struggles. And it's working. For the first time in decades, the opposition is being forced to respond to us. We are on the offensive. Our movement is now defining the terms of the discussion. It's incredible. It's incredible. By bringing BDS to your community, you can take something that feels to many people as something very far away and international. We know it's not. But it feels that way to so many people, and localize it. Turning it into something that's a local issue, that the occupation is everybody's problem, and remaining neutral is not an option any longer. And as BDS resolutions come up for votes in municipalities, church assemblies, universities, and beyond, BDS is challenging people who could once ignore Israeli aggression, who could decide not to come to our film screenings or our vigils or our presentations, to finally take a side, to investigate what this is all about, and to figure out where they stand. Because we're bringing the occupation home, we're putting it on trial, and people have to confront the situation and learn about it. And in that way, BDS is actually, in my opinion, by far the best educational tool that we've ever seen. And now, according to a number of Israeli politicians, top business leaders, mainstream journalists, the wisdom seems to be that the only way to stop BDS and to avoid growing Israeli isolation is to restore Palestinian rights. In other words, BDS is working. We also know that BDS is threatening the status quo, given just how much the opposition is doing to fight it. And I believe that Cecily Zaraski from Jewish Voice for Peace, who's another plenary speaker, is going to be talking more about the ways that the Zionist establishment is fighting BDS and how we can counter that and resist it. So in the less than 10 years since the BDS call's inception, the BDS movement has established itself truly as a force to be reckoned with, and we have achieved milestones once unimaginable. The list is long and growing every day, so I would like to name a few of the ongoing campaigns and victories. It would be really cool to see some of the images. And as I was sort of talking about different types of BDS, so boycott, for example, consumer boycotts, targeting things like Israeli dates made on illegal Israeli settlements, Hewlett-Packard, which provides a lot of the technology used in racial profiling in the West Bank and the rest of Palestine. Consumer boycotts are one form of BDS. Divestment campaigns, like I was talking about, targeting corporations like these. Caterpillar, of course, providing the bulldozers used to demolish Palestinian homes, and olive groves to build the wall, etc. Technology used surrounding Israeli settlements and more. These are readily available facts, so I don't expect you to remember all these details, but it's just to give you a sense of actually the breadth of potential targets, and then we'll talk a bit about how we strategically choose targets to have the most effective campaign possible. And I'll be talking a bit specifically about G4S as well, and there's a whole workshop on it, so I won't mention it there. I mentioned academic and cultural boycott, the ways in which Israeli academia and cultural institutions are part and parcel of Israeli aggression, and how, and I can talk a bit about how people can target those institutions. And then, of course, sanctions is very important. Here's kind of a graphic that can help sort of lay out BDS as a strategy for change. You know, ending the occupation, equality for Palestinian citizens of Israel, and the right of return. Those are those three goals that I talked about. The tagline being freedom, equality, and justice, to match up with those, and then, of course, BDS. So, great. So we've achieved these incredible victories that honestly, I think the last time I was here in the Twin Cities, I don't think any of these had happened yet, and I think that we probably would have thought that they were coming in 20 years, not five. So we have campaigns all over the country, including here in Minneapolis, and it's one of the dots on that map. This is on our website, endtheoccupation.org. I have some brochures out there, but we are a coalition of more than 400 organizations around the country who are working to end all forms of U.S. institutional complicity with the Israeli occupation, including political and diplomatic support for Israeli aggression, and also things like academic, cultural institutions, corporations, etc. And we provide all kinds of support to groups like yours. So talking about some of the victories, students have really led the way in this movement, both, by the way, on BDS and on joint struggle, which I'll be talking more about later. But we see student divestment campaigns and other BDS campaigns unfolding on campuses around the country. These are predominantly often Palestinian-led student organizations. And here is a list that I compiled that is now, I notice, out of date, actually. I mean, there's so many, you can barely fit them on one slide anymore, of just how many different victories we're seeing around the country. It's extraordinary. One of my favorite examples that happened just this year are when students at Wesleyan University, who had been demanding divestment from the Israeli occupation, from fossil fuels, and from private prisons, as they were unable to get any response from the administration and had tried all kinds of other tactics, escalated by actually occupying the offices of the university president to demand divestment, refusing to leave, even, I think, staying overnight or for many hours, in any case, camping out. And lo and behold, eventually the president actually agreed to divestment from one of these three from private prisons, which is an extraordinary victory and shows the way that I think students are really escalating the tactics in a very effective way at a great time to do it. And it's just very inspiring to learn from. And there's a really good video, actually, on it online, if you Google it. Churches, of course, especially presenting at our Friends of Seville conference, churches have been really leading the way as well, particularly on divestment, as well as boycott with the Presbyterian Church of the United States, the United Church of Christ. We have folks I work with on the ground, I think, in both of those here today. This is a screenshot that we saw on June 30th of this year of the UCC vote for divestment, as well as boycott. Divestment from the Israeli occupation. It wasn't even close. It was amazing. I still get chills when I see this screenshot. You know, the Presbyterian Church, which is incredible. There was a 7-vote spread, so it was about 50, you know, 0.001 versus 49.999. Wasn't even close this summer. So we see again that momentum building and the power that we're amassing, and also how awesome the UCC Church is. Quakers. Actually, Quakers preceded both of those. The Friends Fiduciary Corporation divesting from these different corporations involved in the occupation. I'll be talking a bit about Veolia as well, but that started several years ago already. And this is a similar sort of roundup of some of the biggest divestment victories that have happened, not just in the United States, but worldwide. And these are big deals. This is the Dutch ASN Bank. We're talking about national pension funds. We're talking about, you know, major churches, pension retirement fund giants, the Bill Gates Foundation, et cetera, billionaire George Soros. This is no longer can we say that BDS is just about being symbolic. And just about changing the discourse, we're actually seeing money moving in a way that is significant. One of the most exciting victories of this year, of course, was when R&B and I think 8-time Grammy Award winner Ms. Lauryn Hill of the Fugees previously heeded the call from Palestinians and their allies around the world, asking her to cancel a performance in Tel Aviv to hear that BDS call. And she did, in fact. And she joins a list of more and more cultural performers who are understanding that there can be no business as usual with an apartheid state, that it is wrong to go and perform in Israel when we know that Palestinian artists, for example, cannot travel outside, cannot be artists themselves, cannot even attend something like Lauryn Hill's concert. Another amazing victory of just the last year, of course, is Block the Boat. So Zim Shipping Company, Israeli shipping company, which docks in places around the country, including on the West Coast, was stopped by extraordinary coalitions all along the West Coast, blocking the boat, working with workers at the docks in places like Oakland, to work with them, to support them in supporting the Palestinian struggle. By refusing to unload goods from these Israeli ships, and they haven't been back. It's an amazing victory that really builds on the legacy of the anti-apartheid movement. SodaStream is, of course, a classic BDS victory. SodaStream being a homemade sort of seltzer water maker that for many years was produced primarily on stolen Palestinian land in an Israeli settlement. And there were SodaStream campaigns all over. In fact, was there one in here in Minneapolis? Yes, there was. Absolutely. In fact, Minneapolis, of course, is where Target is headquartered. And I remember activists here actually delivering a petition of almost 10,000 signatures to Target. Among probably many other things you did here, and I'll mention this later, but of course there's a wealth of experience here locally in the Twin Cities and in Minnesota on BDS campaigns that there's much to be learned from. But just this year, SodaStream finally has. Well, they haven't entirely shifted, but they are moving their factory headquarters out of the West Bank. Of course, they are now moving on to more stolen Palestinian land in the Negev, and so they remain complicit and remain a BDS target. But the fact that they moved their headquarters out of the West Bank really shows the power of BDS to change corporate policies. So we see that sort of that we're getting stronger and stronger. So I want to talk a bit about Veolia, especially in light of the focus, one of the focuses of this talk being on joint struggle. So Veolia is a multinational French corporation that focuses on trash waste collection, water, transportation, and energy. And it's everywhere if you start looking for their logo, which I don't have on a slide, but I didn't even know they existed, and then now I see them everywhere. But Veolia was really a flagship BDS target, and it started in Europe, and then there were more and more campaigns happening actually in the United States and around the world. It to do things like stopping local contracts with Veolia, because Veolia was deeply complicit in Israel's occupation and apartheid policies, through providing services to settlements, through their involvement in the Jerusalem Light Rail, entrenching the occupation in Jerusalem, etc. So I worked heavily on a Veolia campaign in St. Louis, where I live, as part of the St. Louis Palestine Solidarity Committee, in addition to my role as national organizer. And we found out, and I give this as an example to learn a bit about what a joint struggle BDS campaign can look like, and then perhaps if it has local sort of implications for you guys, and something similar could happen here if it isn't already. We found out that Veolia was trying to gain a contract with our city's water department to what we believe is eventually take over our city's water. It was going to be an incremental, slow thing. But we found out about this at the last minute. Oftentimes it's very hard to find out actually who your city is contracting with, and you find out only when it's too late. But we found out just in time from a leak from a worker who was very disturbed by this, because Veolia, in addition to its complicity in the Israeli occupation, has a history of labor abuses, mismanagement, incredible environmental destruction, is the world's largest water privatizer. So Veolia is a nasty corporation for many, many reasons. And so we, as the Palestine Solidarity Committee, we wanted to mobilize against Veolia. We had our eye on it. But we knew that we couldn't do it alone, that this was a big campaign. And we immediately, as we found out about the contract, began building a coalition with environmental groups with whom we had real relationships. One of our members is also a member of the Sierra Club. We knew the people people involved in the environmental movement in St. Louis, with workers and with others, to build a strong coalition to challenge this contract. We knew, as the Palestine Solidarity Committee, that environmental and labor groups were not going to rally around messaging for a free Palestine. And we didn't impose any sort of top-down messaging. We were building a coalition to challenge Veolia. That was it. And people were free, organizations were free to approach the campaign from whatever their motivation was, their point of accountability and reference was. But we established some agreements early on, about even if we were all going to approach this from different, from different places, and here you can see one of our protests at City Hall, that we would not throw one another under the bus. So we were all going to fight the Veolia contract, and we were not going to allow ourselves to be divided. And indeed, the mayor, different people at City Hall, as well as national media, frequently were trying to divide our coalition because it was so powerful to see the Palestine movement matching up with labor and with the environmental movement. They saw what incredible power that had. And in building our coalition, we understood that it was okay that different groups could bring different things. So the Palestine Solidarity Committee brought a lot of the organizing capacity. A lot of us had done these types of campaigns before. We were able to give powerful firsthand testimonies about what Veolia's policies meant in practice, having Palestinians testify at hearings to our city council about that. Environmentalists could turn up a lot of numbers, especially in the middle of work days. There were a lot of people from the Sierra Club who were retired or who otherwise were able to show up in ways that a lot of working class folks weren't able to do. So they were able to bring a lot of the people at particular strategic times. Organization for Black Struggle was part of our coalition. We had strong ties with them already through our relationships, which I'll be talking more about. And this could not be a priority campaign for them, and we didn't expect it to be. But they did, for example, an op-ed at a very key moment in our campaign in a major black newspaper in St. Louis to add to our momentum and at a crucial time. Workers could not be public as part of the campaign. It would have been a threat to their jobs, but they gave us a lot of intelligence when we needed it. They checked in with us. They kept us accountable. So we sort of, building our coalition, what was really important about that, about having such an effective joint struggle campaign, was meeting different groups where they were at and acknowledging that we were all working from a place of good faith and commitment to justice. And in the end, it actually really worked to our benefit, because it was actually extremely difficult for the St. Louis powers that be to develop an effective strategy to challenge us, because we were everywhere. We appeared to be everyone and everywhere. There was no head. We were decentralized. It was as if the entire city of St. Louis hated Veolia, and they couldn't keep track of us. So I think oftentimes when we're building coalitions, especially, we're looking for everybody to participate in an equal way. We're looking for We're looking for other groups to match, let's say, our organizational culture or our organizational style. We're looking for things to be extremely sort of developed in a very sometimes even corporate way of having our goals and how we're going to meet them by which time, et cetera. And what we found was that it was very useful for us to allow the coalition to be something that we couldn't control all the time. And we won. And so have a lot of other Veolia campaigns around the world. And just a few months ago, after losing more than $20 billion in contracts around the world following BDS campaigns, Veolia finally pulled out entirely from the Israeli market. An incredible BDS victory, just one of so many. So there are, there's a lot of different campaigns to choose from. I want to look at a few different possibilities and then shift the presentation a little bit. But I do want to just really lift up Minnesota Break the Bonds and the work that it has done over the years building up BDS in this community, and just highlight that they are going to be giving a workshop, as well as Tori from Friends of Seville talking about G4S as a target, which I'll mention in this presentation as well. But to really, learn from the experts here in your community. So there's a lot of, you know, different campaigns, and when you're looking at doing one of these BDS campaigns, deshelving Israeli goods at a local grocer, passing an occupation-free Minneapolis resolution in your municipality, perhaps, you know, is your university invested in U.S. companies building the wall and checkpoints, or are they partnering with Israeli academic institutions, or are they hiring G4S, a private security company that helps run Israeli prisons as well as U.S. detention centers? Are they hiring G4S for security? Is your church invested in and profiting from the occupation? A lot of the victories I outlined, you know, there's much more work to be done on those. Are there cultural performers traveling to Israel from the Twin Cities that you might influence to cancel, or are there Israeli sort of cultural ambassadors coming to Minneapolis that you could protest or stop? Sports boycotts, I want to lift up that I think the very first time I saw sports boycott in this country was here in the Twin Cities when Minnesota Break the Bonds actually mounted a campaign challenging the fact that the Minnesota Timberwolves were going to play the Israeli Maccabi Haifa basketball team here locally. And they weren't able to stop the game from happening, but they ran a great campaign that I think really launched the idea of sports boycott in this country. So I want to lift it up. So I do want to mention two key targets from our standpoint of the U.S. campaign as sort of a bridge into joint struggle work, because these are also corporations that are heavily involved in other injustices. One of them is Hewlett-Packard, which provides technology to the Israeli Navy to enforce the blockade of Gaza, enabling the apartheid system and Israeli checkpoints. They're also heavily contracted with the U.S. Department of Defense and the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement in deportations and other racist practices in this country, side of their headquarters. G4S is another key target to look at and to start sort of monitoring its involvement here in your community. It's the largest private security company in the world. It operates Israeli prisons as well as U.S. privatized juvenile detention facilities and a lot more around the world. This is a nasty company. And these are also winnable, I believe, campaigns. These are campaigns that we might be able to see a sort of repeat of Veolia with regard to the occupation specifically. So, you know, there's a lot of great targets. UN is also contracting with G4S. You'll be hearing more about that later this month if you're on our email list. But the most important thing is not having a laundry list of, I don't know, products that you don't buy or companies you don't invest your own dollars in, but really strategically coming together to rally around a specific target, to choose the best target for your context. And I want to talk about some of the criteria that the Boycott National Committee, the Palestinian BDS National Committee, has recommended. And again, I encourage you to go to one of the workshops that's going to talk more in depth about building a BDS campaign. Of course, research, focusing together on one, as I said, looking at your particular context and where you can build power, where do you have influence. And the BNC talks about is the target something that's easy to explain and understand? Is it something that you can describe to people easily? Does it help build power and alliances? So when we're talking about companies like HP and G4S that are involvement in oppression is not limited only to Palestine, but involved in much more, and could be a strategic target for multiple groups. Is it a winnable campaign? Is it something where you can actually have an influence? So these are some things to keep in mind as you pick a target. And there's a lot of support, by the way, out there for you in launching and carrying through with these campaigns, including from our organization, the U.S. campaign. So BDS is one context in which some groups have effectively done joint struggle, like in the Veolia example, but it's really not the only way, or I would say even the main way of doing joint struggle, and I actually think it's a mistake when we approach joint struggle purely from the standpoint of corporations like G4S or HP without really having relationships and common understanding and mutual investment in other struggles. So I'd like to talk a bit about our experience doing Palestine to Ferguson work in St. Louis, where I live, especially giving given the amazing organizing happening here in Minneapolis following the horrible police killing of 24-year-old Jamar Clark, as Kathy was talking about, witnesses say had his hands tied behind his back when police shot him execution style recently, and authorities are now refusing to release the tape of what happened. So I encourage people, in fact, I wanted to ask sort of how many people in this room have been up to the 4th Precinct to protest since Jamar was executed? Okay. How many people in this room have been to Black Lives Matter protests or affiliated actions? And how many folks have done work on police accountability, ending mass incarceration, dismantling white supremacy? Okay. I want to talk a bit about sort of what investment in these things has meant in our context in St. Louis and some of the beautiful connections that we've seen being built in an authentic way. So in addition to my national role, I'm also a local organizer with the St. Louis Palestine Solidarity Committee, which is an anti-racist, Palestinian-led Palestine solidarity organization. And in St. Louis, we've seen extraordinary cross-struggle solidarity that is manifesting between Palestine and Ferguson/Black Lives Matter struggles. This has really been happening more and more on a national scale, and we're seeing the connections being made everywhere, at demonstrations, in news articles, at conferences. There's a recent Black for Palestine statement that was incredibly powerful, and an amazing Black Palestinian solidarity video that just came out. I hope you've seen it. Palestinians are reaching out to places like Ferguson, and Black leaders are traveling to Palestine. It's extraordinary to see it happening in so many places, and it terrifies the Zionist establishment because it is really us building power together. And Zionist efforts that have gone back a long time to co-opt Black leaders are failing. Progressive, except on Palestine, so-called PEPs, are becoming increasingly obsolete. And polls show that as the U.S. becomes less white, it is also becoming less supportive of Israel. So I can say that in our context, locally, in the Ferguson movement in particular, the movement has been unambiguously pro-Palestine. It feels as if you cannot go to a Ferguson event without somebody mentioning Palestine and the crowd erupting in a cheer. And I want to talk about how those connections have been made, because I've learned so much from it. And I want to be clear that a lot of what has been done and has been effective has been specifically by Palestinians in the St. Louis PSC. It could not have done by white people. It could not have been done by white people in the PSC. And the role of white people has looked very different, and we have had to learn and respect our different roles in this work. And I'll be talking a lot more about that in detail in my workshop, which is Showing Up as White Allies, Solidarity from Palestine to Ferguson, about what it has meant to prioritize Palestinian leadership, and specifically the role of white allies and understanding white organizing culture, those types of things. But from the very beginning, PSC members of all backgrounds have been on the ground taking part in actions, meetings. We were staffing safe spaces. Many of us already had long-standing relationships with radical Black leaders, involvement in the Coalition Against Police Crimes and Repression, in the Organization for Black Struggle, with the issues of racism and police accountability. So we were already engaged and committed. And that's why I sort of put out that question about, you know, what people have done so far, because you really can't just start by trying to make those connections. It really starts with showing up and building those relationships and understanding. Just like at seemingly every Ferguson event, Palestine is mentioned, so too would we never have a Palestine Solidarity Committee event on Palestine that did not place our work in a broader anti-racist framework, challenging anti-Black racism and white supremacy and other forms of oppression. Because we believe that challenging militarization and white supremacy and injustice in Israel is incomplete without also confronting and dismantling those systems here in the U.S. And I'll be honest, it's actually caused some friction in our organization. There have been people who really wanted us to keep really focused on Palestine. And to be honest, that the PSC has not been a comfortable space for all of those people. Some of them have decided to leave. And this has been a hard thing, I think, especially for white folks in the PSC. St. Louis is a nice Midwestern city like the Twin Cities. You know, we want to be nice. We want to make sure everyone feels comfortable. Well, what we found was that as we were sort of adjusting our politics to be a more comfortable space for white liberal people, we were actually making that a less safe and comfortable space for other people. So what we found is by having really clear principles, we were actually creating a safe space for new people who have joined, and we've become a more multiracial and intersectional organization than we ever were before. And I can talk more about what that looked like in practice in my workshop. It also means strategic choices about our messaging. So are we playing to the liberal middle, or are we connecting with organizations of color? Sometimes you can do both at once, but not always. Sometimes you have to choose, and strategically we have chosen generally to be building power with other radical struggles. So anyway, we showed up, and we weren't there waving Palestinian flags or holding signs that said Palestinian Lives Matter. Absolutely not. We weren't carrying our organization's banner. We were there to stand in solidarity, lifting up the central message that became Black Lives Matter. When black leaders called for a weekend of resistance, we helped organize a Palestine contingent. So over and over again, we marched, we took part in civil disobedience, we got arrested together. We showed up there to take part in the struggle at hand. Here's part of our Palestine contingent. Just incredible, beautiful moments of cross-struggle solidarity over and over again. Palestinians from the PSC carried a banner at marches in Ferguson saying Palestine stands with Ferguson. They organized later with other people of color-led organizations to march together behind a banner reading United We Fight. So we showed up without centering Palestine, and that was incredibly important. People recognized the authenticity and drew the connections themselves because of their relationships with us. Connections that I think a lot of us are aware of. You know, that there are very real connections between Palestine and Ferguson and Black Lives Matter. You know, the fact that Israeli police are saying tear gas used against protesters in Ferguson and maybe here in Minneapolis too is used against Palestinians in Palestine, that the same corporations and sometimes people themselves are at the top of a lot of these policies. But knowing these connections and articulating them was not what made our work effective. It was not about having politics. It was about one thing, relationships. Who are you in relationship with? Who are you accountable to? And it was through these relationships, through showing up, through building those things that our work was reciprocal, but it wasn't transactional. It wasn't like we show up for you, so you show up for us. Not at all. They were relationships that made it so that we were understanding the ways in which we might be playing out white supremacy, or we might be making mistakes. In fact, we were making mistakes all the time. And I could give some examples, but actually don't. Was that a signal to me to be quiet? I don't know what a time check is. I'll give an example that might be helpful. So about things not being sort of opportunistic, but actually being about building power for each other together. So, okay, Bill Gates Foundation divested last year from G4S. It was a huge victory. We'd run a campaign. In fact, it was a Palestinian-led campaign coming, an international one coming from the Palestinian BDS National Committee, calling on the Bill Gates Foundation to divest from G4S. In our messaging, in our petition, we gave the example that G4S was running Israeli prisons as well as U.S. detention centers. We used that language to talk about G4S and what a nasty company it was and why Bill Gates should divest, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation should divest from it. And then when they did divest, we put out all of this messaging about victory, amazing, you know, mission accomplished, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation divested from G4S. Turns out a lot of our partners in the prison divestment movement felt a little bit thrown under the bus, because to them, G4S was really actually at the bottom of a long list of companies that are involved in U.S. private prisons. And so we'd sort of used their struggle as part of making ours win. But as soon as we won what we needed, we kind of declared, you know, mission accomplished. We had a similar sort of learning experience we'd learned by that time. I believe, with the Veolia victory. So, you know, in August when Veolia pulled out of the Israeli occupation and and Israel altogether, there was a temptation to declare victory and mission accomplished. But Veolia is still violating labor, violating workers' rights all over the world, destroying our earth. It's still the world's largest water privatizer. And so we couldn't have a message of mission accomplished because we had real relationships with these groups that were working against Veolia. And so it allows us to check ourselves and to see where we are being opportunistic as opposed to building power for each other. And that's what it really has come down to. And it's messy, and it's long-term without immediate results, and it's hard, I think, especially for white folks who are used to often defining the pace and direction of everything that we do, including our own activism and including in our activist spaces, dominating those spaces in ways that we might not even realize. But, I can say from personal experience, not ever having had to think about white culture or white organizing culture, or knowing that there was such a thing as white organizing culture, and having paid lip service for a long time about, connecting struggles here with those in Palestine, without realizing the ways that I myself was manifesting white supremacy, even in organizing spaces. There's a lot to learn, I think, in investigating ourselves and doing that personal work, and how we internalize those things and how they manifest in our work and the ways in which we end up reinforcing dynamics of power and privilege in ways that are damaging and can actually make joint struggle, really challenging or even impossible. So, this is sort of an invitation to white folks who really do want to do that difficult work of joint struggle. If you want to talk a bit, and I don't present myself as an expert, I don't think you can ever be an expert. It's a constant process of making mistakes and learning from them. But to continue this conversation in the workshop of what it means to show up as a white ally, and do that personal work and understand what white organizing culture looks like and ways that we might be marginalizing people of color in ways we don't even realize. So anyway, I invite folks who really want to do that work to come to the workshop and we can learn from each other. And with that, I think I will wrap it up. I hope I didn't take more than my time. And if there is time for questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
You have been listening to a presentation to the Peace Action Conference delivered in Minneapolis, Minnesota by Anna Bolter of the U.S. Campaign to End the Occupation. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday when our feature presentation will be an analysis of the Israeli strategy of occupation by Palestinian attorney Diana Boutu. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Is the future of the RAF really a $150 million apiece US jet that's not up to frontline service? No wonder they call it the Lockheed F-35, the scam jet. Around the time of last year's Strategic Defence Review, Chancellor of the Exchequer George Osborne revealed he'd be buying an extra 100 F-35B Lightning jets for the RAF and Royal Navy specifically to equip Britain's new aircraft carriers. Soon after, the US Congress revealed they would be cutting back severely on their orders for the F-35 because of spiralling costs and lack of reliability, cracks appearing in the wings, and a lack of manoeuvrability raising serious questions over whether Lockheed's state-of-the-art jet was even up to the job. With costs put at between £80 and £200 million for each F-35, meaning a programme cost of around £20 billion, is it time to open the air brakes on the scam jet? And according to former Italian mafia man, today's multinational corporations have been modelling themselves quite successfully on the world's most ruthless and successful narco cartels, the international mafia. Is he right? And never mind the human rights, EU companies are selling illegal surveillance software to human rights-abusing regimes where it's not illegal. Former Nazi company Siemens helping the Egyptian military ruler al-Sisi make sure nothing like the Arab Spring can ever happen in Egypt again. And in cybercrime world, it seems our very own GCHQ in Cheltenham was instrumental in making the virus designed to attack nuclear power plants, allowing reactors to run out of control. Is it time to close the Cheltenham donut down and expose these international cybercriminals? Also, as China suggests a Palestinian state headquartered in East Jerusalem, is Netanyahu determined to evict all the Arabs from the city? Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. Martin, I think we better start with this story you pointed out to me about GCHQ in Cheltenham. Reading through it, pretty shocking that they were involved, intimately involved, in creating a computer virus that can let a power station, a nuclear power station, run out of control, and they were actually using it.
Yeah, the Stuxnet virus was created by the Western intelligence services, including GCHQ, as one of the, you know, partnership, if we can call it that, that was involved. And it was designed to wreck nuclear power stations, specifically the Iranian nuclear power stations, although subsequently the virus transferred itself into the onto the internet, and then actually some people suggest played a role in the collapse in Fukushima some years later.
Was a tsunami.
Well, no, the tsunami, but the computer operating systems at Fukushima were not up to scratch because they'd been infected by Stuxnet. And I ask the listener to contemplate. Is it a sensible use of your taxes for GCHQ to create malicious viruses which are designed to destroy the infrastructure of foreign countries, to wit, in this case, the Iranian nuclear program? How sensible is that? Does that sound like a sensible use of your taxes? Because I would regard that. It's basically criminal under international law. And also, of course, creating viruses which wreck nuclear power stations. Can't people see what's wrong with that? Why there might be a problem with it?
From the wider question and Edward Snowden, this sort of fits in, I suppose, that the people at Signals Intelligence, other intelligence services, MI5, MI6, etc., people who do economic warfare as well, that they are using the cover of national security to actually do what is effectively international criminality.
Well, that's right. It's called national security, but it is, in fact, warfare by any other name. And, of course, if the Iranians, for example, in retaliation, were to write a similar computer virus and try and infect Hinkley Point, would we be happy with that? Or would the RAF be bombing them? Or maybe the Iranians should cut out the middleman and just bomb us, since we're trying to bomb them.
It all seems to have come a long way since the heady days of Bletchley Park during World War II, where the codebreakers were going through the Nazi codes and doing what they could to protect Allied forces in World War II. It almost seems as if they've turned into the problem themselves.
Well, as you're probably aware, Tony, the Nazi intelligence infrastructure was recruited lock, stock and barrel into NATO as it was created. So Reinhard Gehlen, who used to head the Gestapo in Eastern Europe, eventually ends up heading the West German intelligence services. And in actual fact, these organisations are frankly not to be trusted. They're above the law, or they think they are, and they engage in activities which are A, unlawful, and B, extremely dangerous to the rest to humanity. They need to be deconstructed completely and reconstructed as democratically accountable organisations. And that is my considered view. We shouldn't just be stroking them on the back and saying how wonderful MI5, MI6 and GCHQ are. They are criminal organisations.
Well, it's not just us talking about this, and I was really disappointed that there's so little UK London media coverage. Makes it, London media look like some sort of propaganda outfit, right? A lot of them, really, because this was in a documentary, the evidence for GCHQ's involvement in developing this Stuxnet virus was in a documentary, and I'll just read from The Register, which is a website that looks at sort of techie issues. The superworm known as Stuxnet, and this was on the 17th of February, and this came out, was but a cog in an active US war program which hundreds of thousands of networks, implants and backdoors in Iranian networks were actively maintained to facilitate a devastating barrage of hacking attacks. 0 days, this is screened at the Berlin Film Festival, claimed that Stuxnet was just one part of an operation called Olympic Games, that itself was part of a wider effort dubbed Nitro Zeus, that involves hundreds of US defense personnel. Fort Meade hackers worked furiously to mop up infected computers after a leak became apparent.
Well, this is the stupidity of this, is that once you've created destructive viruses to take down other people's infrastructure, those viruses can mutate in cyberspace and come back and hit your own infrastructure. In other words, they are as like amateur bomb makers trying to build IEDs in their back garden. And of course, if other states were doing that, it would be regarded as completely unacceptable. And the Americans continuously go on about how the Chinese are trying to take down their internet infrastructure and so forth. And in actual fact, all the evidence suggests that it is in fact the Western intelligence services which lead the pack in this particular nefarious activity.
Are we actually at war with Iran? I mean, because that's what it appears, if we're trying to take out their...
Well, sanctions on another country are effectively a war against them, because it means that, you're basically saying, we won't trade with you.
Well, surely not. No, that's what they are, is a stage towards war.
No, sanctions are effectively a war. I mean, a blockade, for example, during a war is a sanction.
But its financial sanctions are not the same as a blockade.
Well, no, they are effectively
what it
hostile.
Does is it creates... They're hostile, but it creates a market for people to run the sanctions and get stuff
well,
out of the sanctions.
Indeed also. But, I mean, we talked about sanctions on Israel last week. And, of course, that's being made illegal for local authorities in Britain to bring in sanctions against Israel. Meanwhile, we're sanctioning Russia, sanctioning Syria and sanctioning Iran. And the attempt to try and crash the Russian economy, which is the eighth biggest economy in the world, is absolutely bonkers. What if we succeeded and did crash the Russian economy? What do you think would happen on Wall Street and in the City of London if you did that? This is how stupid this stuff is. And we're on the brink of, and of course, cyber warfare has now become an amazingly important thing. I mean, I understand, for example, that when the bombing campaign against Serbia took place in the 1990s, that they could have taken down the Serbian air defences with keystrokes, in other words, by cyber attack. But if they'd done that, then other people would have been able to work out how to do it, and they could have taken down the US and British defences with the same techniques. And, of course, the only answer to that, if you're a military commander, is not to run stuff through the internet, but to have a completely separate set of a completely separate stuff that you run your own way. And, of course, that's exactly what the Russians and the Chinese have been working on.
Well, I'll see if I can get a link to that 0 days film. Certainly we'll make some references to it on our show page, which is www.thisweek.org.uk tonight, 0 days at the Berlin Film Festival, but of course not on the BBC. European spy tech was told to sold to ultra secret branch of the Egyptian government, claims a new report this week. Protesters opposing Egyptian President Morsi have been waving flags in Tahrir Square about this. European companies are selling surveillance gear to the Egyptian government, known for its human rights abuses, Privacy International claimed in a report released this week. An investigation alleged that Nokia Siemens Networks and hacking team had enabled the surveillance of Egyptian dissidents, prompting both calls for greater regulation of surveillance systems and denials of any wrongdoing from the companies in question. The Egyptian police are known for their repressive and brutal tactics, Martin, and this is just helping them along, isn't it? Giving them a nice little helping hand from Siemens.
Yes, and let's make this point that the Egyptian military government seized power, overthrowing a democratically elected government, whatever your views about them, about the Muslim Brotherhood. And in Syria, when the Muslim Brotherhood, because that's who it was, working with NATO, with the Turks, with the Saudis, decided to take up arms against the military government in Syria, as they saw it, although in fact Assad has actually won a democratic election, as has Sisi once he banned the Muslim Brotherhood on a 30% turnout. What if there is an armed uprising in Egypt, the same as the one in Syria? Are we going to send the SAS to train them? Are the RAF going to back up the rebels as they did in Libya? Of course they're not, because we're actually arming and training the other side. But source for the goose is source for the gander. If it's okay for the moderate rebels in Syria, as so-called by the Prime Minister, to take up arms against the government of Syria, then it's perfectly legitimate for similar people to take up arms against the government of Egypt, and of course against the government of Egypt's backers. Just as the Syrian rebels will be trying to kill Russian soldiers on the ground in Syria, so the Egyptian rebels might decide to come and kill the people at Siemens who provided the surveillance equipment. And that's a perfectly logical continuation of the policy. And if we're going to go down the road of revolutionary uprisings, then it's revolutionary uprisings all round. And as Hillary Clinton said about the death of Gaddafi, we saw he died. And that could be exactly the same for King Salman, exactly the same for Sisi, and exactly the same for their allies. Because if I was a democratic revolutionary in Egypt, I might conclude that Cameron was my enemy, and therefore he's a legitimate target in exactly the same way as Gaddafi. And if you're going to go down that road where there is no law, and it is just the strength of the powerful, that's where you're going to end up.
Now, I mentioned at the top of the hour about Siemens originally being a Nazi company, and reading Paul Manning's book, as I think you've done as well, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, it makes it very clear there that what the Nazis were trying to create in the Third Reich was a common market. They actually call it that in the book. Siemens is a very powerful firm, isn't it? I mean, there used to be, for example, Plessy in Britain that made our traffic lights and various other things, that in the late 1980s, the Conservative government allowed a monopoly, a merger where Siemens took over Plessy's, and I just wonder what you make of the way they operate, because one of the things that Paul Manning makes very clear in that book is that they like to operate as cartels, and for example, when the Nazis took over France, the first thing that happened is Deutsche Bank started buying up large amounts of stock before the invasion in French banks, so that those French banks, which owned large areas of heavy industry in France, made it so that when the Nazi troops actually took over places like France and Holland, they pretty much owned most of the industry by that point.
Well, the interactions between the financial forces at the highest level are definitely the way the world is shaped. And what the Paul Manning book was making clear, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, and also Operation JB book, which we've covered on this show many times. And I think it's generally historical knowledge for those who actually look into it, that the Nazi intelligence structure was integrated into NATO's intelligence operation from the get-go in the 1940s, which is why, of course, you got Operation Gladio, which was involved in killing civilians in order to create terror and mayhem so that certain political effects could be achieved. And those techniques of psychological warfare were honed by the Nazi and fascist intelligence operatives such as Klaus Barbie, who was eventually employed by the US to train the Bolivian army in torture techniques. And the linkages between the genuine old-fashioned Nazis, the Gestapo, and the modern Western intelligence services, the MI6, the BND, and the CIA, is intimate. In actual fact, they recruited a lot of the top Nazi intelligence operatives, and that, I suggest to our dear listeners, explains an awful lot of where we've ended up. Because those kind of techniques of using terror, blackmail, assassination, and false flag attacks in order to achieve political goals, which were the stock in trade of the Nazi Party, have become the stock in trade of NATO's intelligence services in Syria and in Britain and elsewhere.
I would say also, reading Paul Manning's book, you know, that actually the industrial policy, the cartel structure of big groups like RG Farben, carbon has also managed to find its way into the policymaking group, the European Roundtable of Industrialists, which actually drafts much of the legislation for the EU. So I suppose we're getting into EU referendum debate territory here.
Well, we're getting into economic theory about cartels. Why do you have cartels? What are cartels? And cartels exist in everything. It's to do with the technology level that you're using. If we're all just selling apples that we've grown on our own orchards, there'll be thousands of potential suppliers.
And
when you're talking about high tech, there's you can't have more than one or two high tech suppliers of particular
goods. It's also to do with contract policy. And one of the things Manning explains is that when there's a competitive bid for a contract, the various members of the cartel, whoever wins, then shares out the production amongst the other members of the cartel. So it doesn't matter who wins.
Well, indeed. And in any case, what the main way in which modern capitalism functions is through so-called oligopoly. Ford don't have to exactly sit down with Volkswagen to decide what the price of cars is going to be. They just have to watch what their competitors are doing. And the idea that this is some kind of free market where the market clearing price is found through thousands of small producers, it just isn't the way the real world works. And ultimately, of course, we should have some kind of planning of this economy. If we're going to cartelise, then those cartels are not free market operatives. They need themselves to be kept under control by the public authorities, possibly to the extent of running things like, we're going to come on to this in a minute, things like arms production should not be in the private sector at all. No way, Jose. It's not competitive in any way, shape or form, partly for security reasons. That means that the most sensible way, if you're going to have an arms industry, the only way to have an arms industry is to have a publicly owned one. That's the cheapest and most effective way to have one. And I suspect that what we're going to talk about with these planes is going to bring that issue to the fore.
Also, Naked Security website this week, German police have been given the go-ahead to use a home-brewed spying Trojan, we're told. In a blast from the surveillance past, the German Interior Ministry approved a new version of the infamous surveillance malware that's been around for years. We were put into play as early as this week. The German-based Chaos Computer Club in 2011 was the first to spot the malware, which is called, among other things, the Bundestrojaner, the Federal Trojan, and which was developed by the German Federal Criminal Police. The CCC discovered that Bundestrojaner could set up a backdoor, remotely update itself, grab screenshots and activate the infected computer's camera and microphone. Now, this is all rolling out in the German police now.
Well, yes, I mean, and the thing is that the purpose of all of this is really to keep control of the general population. If you are a serious military organisation like the PKK, for example, you make damn sure that you don't use anything that can be infiltrated, and basically you don't use
Why be worried about this then?
Why be worried about it? Because it's about control of the population, and we're the general population. That's what they're into. That's why they want all this backdoors and Trojans and spying on everybody. It's not to catch terrorists. Terrorists don't function like that. Terrorists quite deliberately avoid using electronic equipment so that they don't leave any trace of their activities. So you're not going to catch terrorists by doing this, but you are going to be able to find out what the population are doing and blackmail the senior people in it and generally control the minds of the rest.
Now, we don't often do sport on this show, but tonight the FIFA presidential election has been taking place as the show's been going out, and Gianni Infantino is succeeding Sepp Blatter, Martin. But I was very glad to see that Sheikh Salman didn't win this, because there's human rights groups around the world have been condemning him for saying that he was should not yet be a candidate because he was... Although he was standing as to be the new head of FIFA, he's been accused of really serious human rights abuses in Bahrain.
Well, indeed, and also the Saudis are now head of the UN Human Rights Commission, I believe, with the support of the British and the Americans.
I mean, crackdown against pro-democracy athletes, for example, in 2011, Sheikh Salman was running this.
Well, incidentally, the Saudi army actually crossed the border into Bahrain, which is pretty much like the invasion of Czechoslovakia in 1968, but nobody said anything about it.
So what's the relationship between the Saudi royal family and Bahrain, then?
Well, the Bahraini royal family, whose name I've forgotten, they are Sunni Muslims of a similar ilk to the Saudi royal family. But of course, the population of Bahrain is overwhelmingly Shia, as has the population of the eastern province of Saudi Arabia just across the causeway, which is where the oil, the Saudi oil fields are. So you could imagine an independent Bahrain and an independent East Saudi Arabia, Shia run, which would actually control the oil. But of course, that's not what's happening. You've got a military occupation by Saudi Arabia of Bahrain. And guess what? The British are going to build a naval base there. We are going to use our taxes to build a naval base in Bahrain, which the locals don't want. They've made it absolutely clear they don't want it, but the ruling group in Bahrain, the royal family, working with the Saudis, they are more than happy to have a British base there, which will be the same as having an American base there. Now, of course, what I would point
it's
out...
Martin, just it's the House of Khalifa.
Khalifa, OK. Well, I mean, the point I would point out about that, if Britain does go back to having a naval base in Bahrain, and don't forget, Bahrain only got independence from Britain in 1971, when we handed the country over to the Khalifa family... if any British personnel that are in Bahrain, better think on, because the Bahrainis might decide to take the Syrian option and say, hey, we've got British soldiers and seamen and Air Force people here. They are not here at our invitation. They're here at the invitation of the Khalifa family. Maybe what we've got to do is blow some of them up, just like in Syria, and make sure that they understand the price of repressing human rights. Because, as I was saying about Hillary Clinton saying earlier, you know, if you can kill Gaddafi, if he's in the wrong place at the wrong time, then certainly British squaddies who end up in Bahrain are definitely fair game, aren't they?
Well, certainly, talking about fair game, sport, both athletics and football, seems to have been drawn into the international net of competition at the biggest international levels between East and West, doesn't it? We've had the International Athletics Federation, which Seb Coe, I believe, chairs, and now also FIFA has become very highly politicised. Sepp Blatter, certainly, I mean, you know, if you compare Sepp Blatter, he seems like a real pussycat compared to this guy from Bahrain who was standing, and yet we've been told that there's been terrible amounts of corruption at FIFA. It's all got to be moved out there. We've got to move to a wonderful new corruption-free international football.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of this has got to do with the attempt to make the Russians look bad. And so you've seen a similar thing in international athletics where the Russians have been accused of doping more than anybody else, which I think is a bit laughable.
Actually, even the German guy that made the documentary said that's not true.
Well, there you go.
The whole thing was based on.
Indeed,
yeah.
And of course, we're now going to have the next World Cup's going to be in Moscow, so that's the target of all of this. And then, of course, the next World Cup is going to be in Qatar. And the Qatari royal family, like the Bahraini royal family, they don't really have any proper support, although they are able to provide lots of weaponry to militant groups inside Syria who are killing, murdering, bombing, shooting, assassinating people. And maybe, you know, somebody needs to give the Qatari royal family a whack, a bit like Gaddafi, you know, bullet through the head, bayonet up the backside, that sort of thing.
Well, what about sport, though? Because sport can actually be almost like a sort of way of joining countries, can't it? They can be friendly through sport, whereas they might be shouting at each other at an international diplomatic level. Sport can be a great healer, can't it? A bridge between countries. And well, it seems as if, both in athletics and in football, that the chance of that is receding.
Well, that's because they're being dragged into the geopolitical conflicts, aren't they? I mean, sport can't be separate from the rest of society. If there's a war going on, sport's going to be part of the war, isn't it?
Do you think it's part of preparation for war?
Sport, in principle, should be a means of trying to increase communication and so on. I mean, you know, if I think about the Springboks winning the first World Cup in South Africa after Nelson Mandela came to power, that was important in, you know, basically reconciling the white community to the changed regime and so on. And sport can, you know, I've got my interests in sport, particularly in rugby. You know, it's potentially something that's quite a healing and so on. And ultimately, of course, in the future, I would like to see all sort of contests between alpha males and others carried out on the sports field, not on the battlefield. But we're a long, long way away from that when we've turned the Middle East into a chaos and a mayhem, and millions have died and been displaced, and then everybody in this country wants to go in for a nice cup of tea. It's a bit late for that now. Bit late for that. All those who said they wanted to go to war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and now all these people are turning up to say they want to come. They're turning up on your doorstep saying we want your help. Well, that's what was going to happen, wasn't it?
Do you think that the removal of the Russians from the International Athletics Federation over the doping and the removal of Sepp Blatter, who was largely seen as quite a even-handed guy, and the way that he's been demonised, actually, interestingly enough, by the United States,
yep.
who aren't really a footballing nation,
yep.
that this is a sort of perception management going on in sport at the moment?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Sepp Blatter, I mean, I'm not a great expert on this, but I think Sepp Blatter basically was a Swiss diplomat, effectively, and the deal was the Russians get the Moscow World Cup, and then the deal is that the Qataris get the follow-on World Cup because they were in competition to have it. So, in other words, he was an independent fixer, but no doubt taking bribes, as they all do. But he was independent, and as a Swiss, he was trying to make sure that everybody got a piece of the pie. And, of course, what the Americans have done is they're trying to make, as the Russians keep pointing out, they keep trying to push their own laws as if they were international laws, when they are not. So, for example, they insist that nobody is allowed to trade with Cuba, even though most countries haven't got sanctions on Cuba, the US has, and they try to force other countries to have sanctions on Cuba, even though they don't particularly want to have them. And I'm afraid this kind of argy-bargy is very much part of the geopolitical struggle that we're in. But, of course, it's a lot less unpleasant to have people removed from being head of FIFA and sent to retirement than having a bayonet up the backside and a bullet through the head like Gaddafi. But it's all part of the same game.
The Middle East is always seems to be the centre of many of these international conflicts at the moment. Syria, quite clearly, and it has been, ever since I can remember, really, Syria, a bit of a flashpoint between East and West. But Prime Minister's questions this week, there was a question asked about Palestine by an MP who's literally just come back from visiting Palestine.
Imran Hussein.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Last week, I visited Palestine along with several of my honourable friends, where we visited the home of Nora and her family, who have lived in the old city of East Jerusalem since 1953. However, Israeli settlers are now trying to force Nora from her home of over 60 years, and there are many other cases. Does the Prime Minister agree with me that illegal settlements and constructions are a major roadblock that hinder peaceful negotiations?
Absolutely.
And what is this government doing to help prevent the infringement of into Palestinian lives and land?
Yeah. Let me say, I think the question the Honourable Gentleman raises is incredibly important. Look, I am well known as being a strong friend of Israel, but I have to say the first time I visited Jerusalem and had a proper tour around that wonderful city and saw what has happened with the effective encirclement of East Jerusalem, occupied East Jerusalem, it is genuinely shocking. And so what this government has consistently done and gone on doing is saying, yes, we are supporters of Israel, but we do not support illegal settlements, we do not support what is happening in East Jerusalem, and it's very important that this capital city is maintained in the way it was in the past.
Well, I'm glad to see David Cameron talking some kind of sense about this, although I would point out that from the Palestinian point of view, they could take the line of the Syrian rebels, which is the time for talking is over. The time for bullets through the head and bayonets up the backside has come. That's what we say in Syria. Why don't we say that in Palestine? Because we want peace, do we? Well, we don't want peace in Syria, do we?
Well, interesting that the Russians have intervened. I mean, I know they've been interested in what's happening in the Middle East for a long, long time, but they're now saying this, almost like they're saying, well, look, this thus far and no further. We're not having the Israeli government move Arabs out of East Jerusalem. That's part of the original settlement, back after the Second World War, and it's very important that Jerusalem remains at least partly an Arab city.
Well, obviously the Russian position is that it should, and so is the British position. So Cameron, of course, is giving the traditional British position as coming from the Foreign Office.
So are you saying that maybe they're turning a blind eye to what's going on then?
Well, effectively, yes. I mean, if you don't put sanctions on Israel when they don't do what you want, and you're not prepared to go to war with them, although we are prepared to go to war with Syria and Russia, then you're basically saying you can do what you like. But I would argue that we've already gone over the line now. We have been arming and training Islamist rebels in Syria. Now, if we're going to do that, we might as well train and arm Islamist Syrians, Islamist rebels in Palestine, in Egypt, in Bahrain. Let's get it over with. Let's get them all up against the wall, shoot them like they did with Gaddafi, and then we'll be democracy and freedom forevermore. Because we all know that war is the answer. It's the answer in Crimea, it's the answer in Syria, and that's what the British position is. That's where we're at.
You pointed out to me as well during the week, Martin, doing very good. We're doing very well this week. Hezbollah has got a Christian brigade fighting. Is it interesting how the way that you wouldn't necessarily expect that from Hezbollah, and we hear a lot from the sort of Christian Zionist point of view supporting Israel, but not so much supporting Hezbollah from the Christian point of view. There is a Christian brigade amongst the Lebanese fighters now.
That's right, because the situation in Lebanon is quite complex. You've got
Isn't it a fairly westernised country? A lot of the government has sold off, privatised.
It's probably one of the more open societies in the Middle East, but it's a very, very mixed denominationally and so on. So you've got some.
ISIS are fighting in there too, aren't they?
ISIS are functioning there, helped and supported by the Saudis as they are elsewhere. And Hezbollah has an alliance with the Christian community against the extremist Wahhabis. And so it's not just an alliance. I mean, in the past, the Christians used to have their own militias, phalangist militias, who were quite right-wing, and in fact involved in the Sabra and Shatila massacres with the Israelis. But what's beginning to happen, and Hezbollah are a Shia organisation, but they're also a patriotic organisation, and they have gone to the Christian community and said, you know, if you want to fight alongside us against ISIS, we will allow you to form your own, we will train you, and we will put, you know, you don't have to change your religion to fight alongside us. We're all Lebanese, let's fight together, and we will train you and arm you. And, of course, that's the real world we're in, the world of warfare. And the British can't say that they don't want warfare. We support armed rebels in Syria. And if you're going to support armed rebels in Syria, armed rebels are armed rebels. We've got to support them in Kurdistan, for example, in Turkey. We've got to support them in Egypt and in Bahrain, obviously. Means that British soldiers who go to Bahrain, as I said earlier, are going to be fair game, aren't they? In the warfare world in which we live.
There was talk about a truce in Syria this time last week. And there's now talk about a truce too. A week later, Syrian rebel factions say they will respect a two-week truce, according to The Guardian, a few hours ago. CNN say Syria temporary truce is nearing, but fighting continues. What do you think? There's any real hope of a truce? And if so, is it going to be a complete truce right across Syria? Because certainly Assad and the Syrian Arab Army don't say they don't want a truce. They don't want to stop fighting ISIS.
No, but I mean, the agreement is that nobody's going to stop fighting ISIS. But of course, everybody knows that. I mean, the question is, who's supporting ISIS?
Well, the Turks certainly seem to. So they're part of NATO. Yeah. So is that a British position?
Well, what's beginning to happen is that the Russians are negotiating directly with the Americans to try and sort out some kind of agreed deal. Now, that's what should have happened years ago, but the West didn't want a deal at that stage because they were supporting the armed rebels, the al-Nusra Front, who are al-Qaeda Syria, and ISIS were definitely being supported by Qatar and Saudi Arabia and the Turks, and also, of course, the British special forces and intelligence people are on the ground in both Jordan and Turkey, along with their American counterparts, up to their eyeballs in all of this. And it may be that we've reached a point where everybody's going to back off, but I suspect not. This is a pause before we go over the cliff. We've been pursuing a policy of armed uprising in the Middle East for the last 5 years. And the time to say we don't want any more armed uprising because we've had enough now, it's too late for that. NATO, Turkey is a NATO member. We are part of NATO. Turkey supports ISIS. Turkey is trying to crush Kurdish democratic forces. We are implicated in all of that. And ultimately, we are at war. And we are going to lose because we're on the wrong side fighting for the wrong stuff. And we deserve to lose if that's the case.
Well, one of the big international conferences happened just a few weeks ago in Munich. We've got in July, of course, the big NATO annual conference, which I think is taking place in Warsaw in July. And this whole business of the conflict between Britain and Russia, or NATO and Russia, came up at Prime Minister's Questions this week.
Michael Ellis.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Mr. Speaker. Does my right honourable friend agree with me that with the NATO summit in Warsaw pending, with the threat of expansionism from Putin's Russia and the national security threat from Daesh, we are right in this party, this government, to support 2% of our GDP towards defence? And isn't he shocked at the failure of the party opposite to do likewise?
I think my honourable friend makes an important point, which is we do face an insecure and unstable world, particularly with what Putin has done in the Ukraine, particularly with what we see in Syria, and that's why I think 2% spending on defence and making sure we renew our nuclear deterrent is the right answer. To be fair to the Labour Party, they have got an answer. They're not going to spend 2%. They're not going to renew our Trident submarines, but they've come up with a really brilliant answer. They are bringing back, as their spokesman and spin doctor, Damien McBride. That is, 6 months after saying, and this is the Leader of the Opposition, we can win in 2020, but only if we spend the next 5 years building this movement and putting forward a vision for the new kind of politics. Honest, kinder, and more caring. 6 months on, Damien McBride is back. That says it all.
Well, it's the usual knockabout nonsense at Prime Minister's questions, isn't it? We could talk about Damien McBride, who cares? Let's talk about Russia and Syria.
He was special advisor to Brown.
He was. He's incidentally one of the sort of person that predicted that there was going to be a crash very shortly, and he's probably right. Now, all this stuff about Russian aggression in the Crimea and in Ukraine. As we've discussed many times on this show, the shootings in the Maidan Square 2 years ago were carried out by Pravi Sector working with Western NATO intelligence services. The shooting down the MH17 plane, it's becoming increasingly clear, was carried out by fighters from Kiev, probably with agreement with the British and
when
the Americans.
When you say fighters, you mean...
aircraft. In Syria, Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister,
just before
is on the record.
Martin, can you just point us to some evidence for that? Where is the evidence that it was Kiev, Ukrainian fighter jets that shot it down?
I'm reading lots and lots of documentation about this all the time. Unless I've written it all down, I can't tell you exactly what I've been reading. But the point is that they haven't followed a normal procedure for an air crash. And all of the evidence, and they've got satellite footage of everything that happened. The US definitely has satellite footage of everything that's happened. We've not seen any of it. And you know why? Because it doesn't fit the story. The Russians have shown what they've got and they've pointed the finger. Now, what we've got to understand is that the so-called Russian aggression is, in fact, aggression by NATO against Russia. The coup in Ukraine, because that's what it was carried out by Western intelligence services. And it was a very bloody coup in which a lot of people were killed, including supporters of the change of regime, who were killed in a false flag sniper attack.
Can I just point out one thing about the MH17 crash you mentioned there in Ukraine? There should be some pretty precise details about exactly what happened on that, and there has been an inquiry, but there hasn't been a full release, has there, of the equipment from the black box, for example?
No, the black boxes were handed over in good faith by the Russians to the inquiry, and then they were given to the British, and that's the last they heard of them. And that's because the black boxes probably show that the story put forward by NATO is a cock and bull story. Now let's come to Syria, which is even more important. Roland Dumas, the French foreign minister, was on French television over 2 or 3 years ago, and he said that before the Arab Spring, I was approached by British officials, he presumably means MI6, who said, we are going to run an armed uprising in Syria. Do you want to participate? Now, that is prima facie evidence that MI6, who are paid for from your taxes, dear listeners, were involved in creating the war in Syria, which has now killed hundreds of thousands of people and created millions of refugees. Now, what should you do to the people at the head of MI6 and presumably in the cabinet who made the decision to make a war in Syria? What would we say to those people at Nuremberg? They were hung. That's what happened to the people at Nuremberg. Hung. Is that what should we do with these people?
You talked about refugees there, Martin. Now, it's one of the most horrific sides of all this. People who have got no choice. Some, of course, are economic migrants, but many have got no choice about fleeing for their lives with their families. Many in the hands of the mafia who are there to get them across the Mediterranean. But before they reach Greece, Italy, and countries like this, quite often these boats are themselves raided by pirates, effectively, apparently pirates anyway. But I spoke to Kevin Boylan on the Dialect programme earlier this week about these raids by the so-called German commandos, called German commandos because most of them seem to speak German, and also that they wear these balaclavas, look like commandos, and they raid these ships as they're going across, these poor defenceless people, take all their valuable possessions off them, and sometimes if they cause any problems, and even if they don't sometimes, then spill their fuel so that they're stranded in the middle of the Mediterranean with no means to get across to the north. So this is a horrific situation, but it looks, at least according to Kevin, as if this may be being sanctioned through the EU and by the EU, and that these may be in some way kind of almost like official pirates.
The evidence is overwhelming that this is a systematic and organised activity, politically sanctioned, if not also financially backed at a high level. It is certain that elements within the Greek police and Coast Guard are involved. And a number of these, up to 50%, according to Human Rights Watch researcher Eva Kosse, are fascists in Golden Dawn. Yet there are also consistent reports of other elements that either speak to the Greeks they work with in German or English. These may or may not be connected to Frontex, the European Border Police Agency, which certainly does work with the Greek Coast Guard and police. As we know, there have been recent attempts to militarise Europe's borders, and pronouncements to this end are being made regularly and with increasing frequency by European leaders in the media. NATO too has got involved, and a recent article in The Independent mentioned a NATO naval task force is being sent to the Mediterranean from the Indian Ocean to help intercept refugees, in collaboration with the Greek and Turkish authorities. It is unclear what such a show of force is supposed to do, as the task force includes several destroyers and an aircraft carrier.
Well, it's probably to do with the deployment of the naval stuff is probably to do with the general tensions that are going on in the Eastern Mediterranean anyway, because there's a potential for this to become a major war.
But, I mean, people are obviously making a lot of money by pointing guns at refugees and stealing everything that they possess.
Well, don't forget that the Erdogan regime in Turkey was making loads of money out of supplying weaponry to ISIS and other groups and selling oil on their behalf. And, of course, also they then opened the refugee camps in Turkey, which they were perfectly happy to have at one stage, because they were using them to recruit
until about May last year,
and then they pushed them in the direction of Western Europe in order to increase the pressure on the Western Europeans to support their attempt to overthrow Assad.
Do you think the failure to deal with the mafia in the Mediterranean, etc., is going to be the undoing of the EU?
Well, the failure to deal with the mafia are integrated into the governmental structures of Italy
and
the country.
They're also making quite a lot of money out of the refugee camps in Italy.
Well, indeed, there's money to be made, and of course, the Erdogan family in Turkey are major profiteers on the arms smuggling to the terrorists inside Turkey, on the arms oil smuggling out of Turkey, much of which ends up in Israel, and of course on the people trafficking. There's money to be made everywhere for those who are war profiteers, and war profiteers like war, don't they?
Well, Britain was involved, always seems to be involved in piracy. There's a lot of things, not of evidence now, to link the Somali pirates to British mercenary groups that were several years ago. There's a lot of complaints about what are these pirates doing off of Somalia, that they may well have been linked to mercenary groups. And of course, Blackwater, who went out with their own navy to try and sort these people out, it may have just been a kind of game they were playing. But if you go back far enough to Captain Kidd in the Caribbean, he was actually working for the British Crown. It was only when he started to talk about the fact that he was actually working for the British Crown and he had the protection of the Royal Navy, that he had his head chopped off. He was brought to the Tower and hanged.
Well, you mentioned the Royal Navy there. I sent you an interesting article this week. It was about a documentary about Sweden in the 1990s, and the Royal Navy were pretending to be Russian submarines coming into Swedish waters in order to make the Swedes more hostile towards Russia. It wasn't the Russians who were invading Swedish waters, it was the Royal Navy. And that then led up to the assassination of Olof Palme, the Social Democrat Prime Minister of Sweden, because the NATO bosses thought he was too soft on the Russians. He was just about to go and meet Gorbachev, he was assassinated. The Royal Navy were involved with the Swedish Navy in attempting to try and destabilise him before he was assassinated. Should the people at the top of the Royal Navy been doing that? Should they be put on trial, do you think, for being involved in doing stuff like that? Maybe they should. Maybe we should dismantle the whole lot and start again.
Anyway, there's a fantastic article this week on gizmodo.co.uk, which I'd not come across before, but it's a brilliant piece of writing, very well researched, and it's about this F-35B, Martin, which is going to be costing around about £20 billion of our money, which is supposed to be sitting on aircraft carriers and things like that, this new jet. Embarrassing technical stumbles, though. Engine fires, non-functioning cannon, a $500,000 helmet that fits comfortably in the cockpit on a pilot's head, but reportedly not in both, and also that there's a lot of impolite things that the pilots have been saying about this plane. They did a mock combat with an F-16 from the 1970s. The F-16 won hands down, so one wonders whether these things are actually going to be able to do what they're being told. Also, Martin, cracks in the wings, which means that many of the jets in the United States that the pilots now have been told that you can't turn corners too sharply. You've got to take a nice long way round the corner. But, I mean, this is a Britain. Bristol's the centre for defence procurement here in Britain, with Abbey Wood up at Filton. What do you make of this? How on earth something that looks like such a pig of a plane, some have called the scamjet, that we're prepared to spend so much, where even the American Defence Department are now reining back on their orders. They're saying, actually, this thing doesn't look like it's going to do the job. We don't want them.
Well, the fact is that because we've got a military-industrial complex in Britain and the United States, the more money we spend on useless equipment, the better, from the point of view of those supplying the equipment, as long as they get away with it. And eventually, of course, they don't get away with it. Well, the Russians, of course, have got a state-run military industry, and it'll be very interesting if it does come to a shooting war between the British, the French, the Americans and the Russians over Syria, whose equipment is going to stand up, because everybody's having a very good look at who's actually got the best equipment. The Russians, because they've got a publicly run defence industry, every ruble they spend on defence, they think very carefully about what they're going to spend their money on and what they're hoping to achieve by spending it. Whereas, of course, the more money that's spent on defence in Britain, the more salaries there are going to be for top executives at BAE Systems, whether the stuff's rubbish or not. And well, that makes more of a difference, really.
Well, just from a couple of years ago, there was the example of the USS Donald Crook, wasn't there, which the Russians just took out, literally, like that.
Well, the other thing, of course, is that aircraft carriers are obsolete.
I mean, electronically.
Yes, yeah. They took it out electronically. Aircraft carriers are obsolete. What the Chinese and the Russians have been developing is cheap, effective missiles which knock out aircraft carriers. And if it comes to a fight, it may well be that the aircraft carriers that we, the two aircraft carriers that we've got and the many more that the Americans have got, will all be taken out in the first few hours of any conflict.
So how does it come that £20 billion of our money, George Osborne signs a little chitty to say we're going to be spending this on the F-35 without any kind of checks? Does he actually not know what he's doing?
Well, because the problem with any kind of procurement for the military is that for security reasons you can't really have a competition. We could probably buy cheaper and better stuff from the Chinese, but then they're the enemy. We could probably buy cheaper and better Russian stuff,
also,
but then they're potential enemies, so you can't buy that, can you?
This article uses a lot of quotes from a guy called Philip Sabin, and he's a professor of strategic studies at the War Studies Department of King's College in London, with a specialisation in air power. He's held research fellowships at Harvard University and the International Institute for Strategic Studies. He's now a consultant at the Ministry of Defence. I wonder how long for, because he's saying this thing is not going to work.
Well, that's right. Eventually, some people blow the whistle about this, about the SA-80 rifle, which was built by the private sector in the end and is basically regarded by serving soldiers as a piece of junk. And that's the problem with the military-industrial complex. They didn't lose the Vietnam War. America lost the Vietnam War, but the military-industrial complex didn't lose the Vietnam War. Every bullet fired, every bomb dropped is a cash register going ka-ching as far as they're concerned.
Last Saturday was the sentencing for the anti-tank missile, which was amongst the largest ever UK weapons cache found by police in Suffolk, Martin. Actually, enormous amount of weapons found by someone who was working for the local parish council. And this guy was had loads and loads of unlicensed guns, a massive haul of weapons. Not a Muslim or a jihadi in sight.
No, well, I don't know what was exactly happening in that particular context, but of course the Gladio networks...
463. Basically, it's enough to arm a very powerful battle group.
Yeah, well, the Gladio networks, which carried out all the terrorism in Western Europe from the 70s and the 80s onwards, they had all of these secret arms caches that they were using, which had been provided at taxpayer expense for them to use. The military-industrial complex is very expensive and well out of control and will drag us to war unless we stop them. But, of course, once they get to the war that they want, they may find that they don't like what they've got.
And in the meantime, let's go now to have a listen to Roberto Saviano, who's written this book called 000. He's suggesting very clearly that one of the models, or the most important model that multinational corporations and banksters in the West here are using, is the mafia model of the narco cartel. And here he is reading, this isn't actually him, someone reading from his new book, 000. 000 actually is the very best quality flour used in pasta, but it's also used in the cocaine trade, that term.
Kiki got drugs through everywhere with remarkable ease, and El Padrino's clan paid willingly. It seemed that Kiki could bribe everyone, could get everything across the border smoothly. It was because of this extraordinary trust, which Kiki had earned over time, that they began talking to him about something they never had mentioned to anyone. El Bufalo. After the umpteenth tractor trailer loaded with Colombian coke and Mexican grass made it over the American border, Kiki was taken to Chihuahua. He'd heard people mention El Bufalo 1,000 times, but he'd never understood what it was exactly. A code name? A special operation? A nickname? El Bufalo was not the boss of bosses or some sacred, venerable beast, even though it was usually spoken of with reverence. El Bufalo was one of the biggest marijuana plantations in the world. Over 1,300 acres of land and something like 10,000 peasants working it. Every protest movement in the world, from New York to Athens, from Rome to Los Angeles, was characterized by marijuana use. Parties without joints? Political demonstrations without joints? Impossible. Weed, the symbol of a light buzz, of togetherness and feeling good, of sweet relaxation and friendship. For a long time, almost all the marijuana that Americans smoked, the grass consumed in universities in Paris and Rome, the weed toked at Swedish demonstrations and on German picket lines, was grown in El Bufalo. That's where it came from, before mafias delivered it around the world. They needed Kiki to get more trucks through, more trains full of El Bufalo gold. And Kiki agreed. On the morning of November 6, 1984, 450 Mexican soldiers invaded El Bufalo. Helicopters rained down soldiers who ripped up marijuana plants and seized what had already been harvested, entire bales ready for drying and chopping. Between what was sequestered and what was burned, $8 billion worth of weed went up in smoke. El Bufalo and all its plantings were under the control of Rafael Caro Quintero's clan, and it operated with the full protection of the police and army.
Well, it obviously went wrong for that operation. But, Martin, seriously, this is a very, very powerful international force, the narco cartels. But it looks like the big banks are managing to model themselves on the way they've operated as basically criminal organisations.
Well, all organisations have an organisational imperative. The real problem is that the banks are basically funded by the drug cartels and the intelligence agencies, specifically the CIA, but not just them. Fund their various nefarious activities in places like Colombia through drug smuggling, as we found out during the Iran-Contra affair in the 1980s when El Bufalo was functioning. We've basically got a criminalised elite. a criminalised elite that wants war but doesn't really understand the implications of having a war, because they think war is just about making money. And when you actually come up against real opposition, as they may well do in the Middle East in the next few weeks, we'll see how useless some of their very expensive equipment is and how badly thought out their geopolitical strategy actually boils down to being.
OK, thanks, Martin. Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. That was an extract from 00.
Welcome, I am Maliheira Zazan, and from KPFA Studios in Berkeley, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa, and I'm here with my colleague Khalil Bendi. Good afternoon, Khalil.
Good afternoon, Maliheira. This week we will bring you a lecture by prominent anthropologist, Palestinian rights activist, and director of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, Jeff Halper, on his brand new book, War Against the People, Israel, the Palestinians, and Global Pacification. The first of a kind, in which he looks at Israel's role in the transnational military-industrial complex and what he calls the pacification industry. Dr. Halper details the integration of Israeli militarized systems, including databases tracking civilian activity, automated targeting systems, unmanned drones, and more, which have become seamlessly integrated with everyday life. Occupied Palestine, he argues, has been a veritable laboratory for that integrative approach.
And we are in the second week of KPFA Winter Membership Drive, and this kind of programming is made possible by you. So please do help us so we can reach our goal by calling 1-800-439-5732. That's 1-800-439-5732 or 1-800-HEY-KPFA. And you can also pledge securely online at kpfa.org. Now, let's hear to Dr. Halper's lecture that he gave in January last month in Belgium.
All the time I was looking down at the occupation, house demolitions, land expropriation, you know, settlements, everything going on, I said, what if I looked up at Israel's place in the bigger world to begin to see what is Israel's relation to the rest of the world? How can I explain the support that it gets? And more, of course, the contact would be a military security, kind of an export. Because it became clear to me over time that the Palestinians were not the actual targets of the Israeli military. You can't explain in 2014 this disproportionate attack on Gaza in military terms. In other words, these missiles that are these rockets that Hamas was shooting cannot explain the tremendous military force that Israel used on Gaza. We're talking about it like a conventional war. I mean, Israel carpet-bombed Gaza with artillery from its navy, F-16s, laser-guided missiles, tanks, artillery, drones, of course, and ground troops with all the power of their weaponry against Gaza. You know, against people with no army who are throwing, some rockets, but not doing much damage. And certainly not justifying that kind of attack. Something else was going on. And it began to occur to me more, but and to other people, that in fact the occupied territory is a laboratory for testing and developing new weapons. And the Palestinians are, in the end, the guinea pigs that you experiment on. They're not the targets. They're not the end users of all this military. They're simply the ones you try your weapons or your surveillance systems, security systems on for export. So it seemed to me then that Israel's major export is the occupation. All the different aspects of occupation, from the weapon systems that it develops to surveillance systems. I mean, you've got 600 checkpoints in the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem. Well, they're all manned by companies. One of the major Israeli surveillance companies is called NICE Systems. How's that for a name company? NICE Systems. That's one of the world's leaders in creating digital security for cities that link police and security and cameras and all kinds of technologies in a real totalizing kind of a way. Well, of course, that equipment is developed and that technology is developed in the checkpoints. Why is Israel one of the world's leaders in airport security? Biometrics, the reading of eyes, voice recognition, body recognition, all these things that go into these modern surveillance systems. Because it has millions of Palestinians. There's magnetic tags, there's all kinds of technologies that you could use. Plus, of course, what I call the matrix of control, this model of control that Israel has developed over the Palestinians over the last 100 years, actually, that it can also export. So I think, from my point of view, that's the quid pro quo. That begins to explain things. The fact that Israel becomes a center for the export of the military systems, security systems, surveillance systems, and models of control in a world, and we just have to go outside Brussels and you can see it, that's preoccupied with security. So Israel is, in a sense, lucky in that it's able to very quickly to move into a world and become a world's leader in a world that's very preoccupied with security. It's really a globalized Palestine. In other words, your police forces and security forces and militaries are being Israelized in terms of their weapons and their tactics and so on, which means that you, the people, are being Palestinianized. We have a slogan in the Israeli peace movement that we're all Palestinians. And we mean that, of course, in the sense of solidarity. But literally, you could say, we're all Palestinians in the sense that we're all today on the receiving end of the same weapons and tactics that are used on Palestinians that come into our communities in Europe. I mean, Debbie and I were talking before, following this line, I mean, I know that Intel is working in others, the ECCP and others, are working on Elbit systems and BDS around the military systems. But in a much larger way, following this military security line is a way of, in a sense, connecting up different struggles in different places. And if we're all Palestinians, if all our military forces are coming together all over the world and being Israelized, in that sense, you create a kind of a solidarity and a kind of a common situation that allows us to work across borders. So I think this is an issue much larger than simply taking one piece of it, drones or Elbit or whatever. We should be looking at this at the system. Now, what I also do in my research in the book, I'm less concerned about Israel. I mean, I'm concerned about how Israel gets away with it. But beyond that, I think there's other important questions as well. And that is, using Israel as a case study, you begin to see the nature of militarization and security in the rest of the world. Now, this is an issue that the left, I think, it's a blind spot in the left. And the military security industries in the world are a €2.5 trillion a year industry. So their impact on societies, on economies, on conflicts is huge. You know, the largest polluter in the world is the military. I never hear the Greens talk about military as more than corporations. In other words, this huge economic, technological, security control area of world politics is not on the agenda of the left. I mean, around certain things, around drones maybe, around a particular attack, maybe Iraq or Gaza or something, but overall it's not an issue that the left has really talked about much, and maybe it's because we don't know much about it. And I have to admit, I wrote a book about something I know nothing about. Now, what do I know about the military? I couldn't tell you a rifle from a tank. Who knows this stuff? We're not interested in that. Most of us come from the social sciences, so we don't know science very well. So you talk to me about nanoweapons or enhancing soldiers genetically. I have no idea what you're talking about. We don't know, and I think that's a big danger for us, is we don't know the technologies of control that are being developed. So when we're talking about resistance, I don't think we really know exactly what the powers that are out there that we're resisting. So partly I did in my book, I apologize in the book, in the middle especially, where I go over weapon systems. I'll do it a little bit tonight. Just so we begin to know what these systems are, because they're not things we talk about very often. So on that level, you know, Israel becomes a case study. It's not so Israel-focused, but it's focused on the idea of globalizing Palestine. So it's a wider process of control and securitization that I'm writing about. But there's even a higher level, because I think that we don't talk enough today about capitalism and the whole capitalist world system we live in. I don't have to convince any of you, I know, but in a way, even talking about capitalism sounds old-fashioned. It sounds like we're back in the 50s, you know, and who talks about, you know, and that's the success of the capitalist system, is that it's rendered itself invisible. So I was saying to Danny before, there's a joke about one fish says to another fish, "How's the water?" And the other fish says, "What water?" That's how we are in this capitalist system. I think young people, including activists, don't perceive that they're in a system in a way. We feel certain issues, environmental issues or women's issues or development issues or debt issues or whatever. We don't see where they're coming from. We don't have the bigger context anymore, partly because even talking about that bigger world system has been made weird and old-fashioned, and we don't even want to hear it, the languages. And so what I'm trying to really do also is to bring that back in a way, and to say you can't understand the logic of securitization and militarization and so on unless you understand the whole world system that it's coming from. So it's going from the very micro, Israel and the Palestinians and how it gets away with it, to looking at the role of arms in international politics, what I call security politics, within the context of capitalism. So I just want to take a couple minutes and just say something about the capitalist system, just to kind of give us a certain something to hold on to theoretically in terms of analysis. Capitalism was very clever in that there's a hegemony of capitalism. It's not direct rule. There's a hegemony, and with hegemony, you don't feel it very much. But it has to be enforced. Capitalism enforces its hegemony over us. So there's three aspects that are really important for the functioning of a capitalist system in terms of enforcement and control. One is military operations. Countries that make up the international system that work with corporations and have their armies, and the armies are all related to each other, are very strong military forces. Today, you don't have any more interstate warfare like you used to have. The last real big interstate conflict is probably Korea. World War II. You had a few little interstate wars over the years. 73 war with Israel and Egypt and Syria. Iran-Iraq. Maybe the American invasion of Iraq. Although it was so asymmetrical that it's hard to talk about that as a real interstate war. The British and the Falkland Islands, the Malvinas. Maybe the Russians in the Ukraine. But again, these are very localized kinds of conflicts. Basically, you can't explain why governments are investing in weapon systems of billions of euros. Nuclear weapons, F-35 jet fighters, nuclear-capable submarines, when your enemy is ISIS, Daesh, or Al-Qaeda, or Mexican drug cartels. They're not state actors. I mean, you can't fight those wars using Trident nuclear missiles. So why are they still producing them and putting all this money in? And I think the reason is it's intimidating to everybody. It's saying, and the Americans actually say this, we want everybody to know that if they challenge either American hegemony or capitalist hegemony, we have the power to destroy them, whether them is a non-state actor or them is China, whoever it is. So we need what the Americans call full-spectrum domination. Not that we're going to use it, but it's that threat that's always there. Where they actually do use to enforce their hegemony all over the world is what's called war amongst the people. A term that I got from a British general whose name is Rupert Smith. He's supposed to be the most intellectual British general, which is a little bit of a contradiction in terms. Who wrote a book called The Utility of Force. And he says that interstate warfare is gone. And in fact, what we're fighting today, the new paradigm of warfare, is what he calls war amongst the people. Urban warfare, counterterrorism, counterinsurgency, controlling populations and people. I took that term in my book, the title of, and I made it what it really is, which is war against the people. That's where the title of my book comes from. But his term is war amongst the people, which has to do with, there's a whole different aspect of war. You know, when we think about war, we have an anti-war movement and peace. We think about war in a conventional sense. But in fact, that's pretty much gone. And war is very dramatic when it happens. It's a lot of violence, a lot of death, big, sexy weapons. It leaves an impression. But in fact, today, war is actually policing and discipline. In other words, war today against the people is fought in Brussels. It's fought in Syria against the Occupy movement. In different places. In other words, it's fought against poor people, peoples of color, refugees, migrants, and dissidents. Those are the people that wars are fought against. In other words, anybody that's threatening to disrupt in the international capitalist system. So war is actually policing. What's interesting is we don't pay much attention. Police aren't as sexy as soldiers. The police are there all the time. The police are your friends, in a way. Everybody wants security. So in some ways, people are saying, well, it's good that the police are around. So the police become an acceptable, everyday, non-issue. But in fact, that's what war is today. Whether it's class war, or wars to control populations, resource wars is one of the major forms of warfare today. Because you've got in the world this whole wide belt around the equator. That's where a lot of the most valuable resources of the world are found, and the poorest populations. So the question is, how do we extract the resources but exclude those populations from the whole capitalist system.
And that's the voice of Dr. Jeff Halper, prominent anthropologist, Palestinian rights activist, and the director of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, speaking on his brand new book, War Against the People, Israel, the Palestinians, and Global Pacifications, the first of its kind, in which he looks at Israel's role in the transnational military-industrial complex and what he calls the pacification industry. I am Maliha Razazan. You are listening to Voices of the Middle East and North Africa on KPFA in Berkeley and KFCF in Fresno. And we are going to take a short break to ask you to support KPFA during this a winter membership drive. I'm joined in the studio by my colleagues Khalil Bendib and Philip Maldari. Thank you so much, Philip, for coming in.
Well, thank you for inviting me. And I'm really impressed by this man and his insight into all of this. I'm really grateful that you chose this to put on Voices of the Middle East this afternoon, because he's articulating stuff that, though many of us maybe sort of have an inkling of what the U.S. is doing, what Israel's doing, and what the capitalists are doing, but connecting the dots is what this guy does, and connecting the dots is what we all need to do.
1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Khalil and Philip, we are offering the CD of this lecture. It's 2 hours. And he goes, as he says in the beginning, he goes through these various systems of both military and also sort of security system that's been used by Israel and how it's been exported to other countries. And we are offering the CD for a pledge of $50. This was a talk that he gave. It's really fascinating. In Belgium last month, we are also offering the book War Against the People for a pledge of $100, both of them a combo for $140. It's and what I like about this, as you said, Philip, it connects the dot. It's really interesting what he says, that war really has transformed in its conventional ways that we have accustomed to in terms of tanks and missiles. It has turned and it has spread to our cities and it has become integrated in part of our daily lives. 1-800-439-5732 or kpfa.org. Khalil?
Yes, these are original and fascinating insights that nobody else really brings to the table except for Jeff Halper. It's very interesting how he's able to show how this internationalization of police oppression melds into what we usually see as war in Palestine, and is being exported to all countries, as you said, including this one. When we see the way that people here, minorities, poor people, are being treated, it's very reminiscent of what we see in Palestine. It's a great concept to call the Palestinization, or the Israelization rather, of the world. Just today, in today's front pages in the Chronicle, there's this homeless encampment that's coming under attack, and it sounds like a military campaign. They're just going to get rid of these people one way or the other.
Well, I love the word pacification. It sounds so sterile or antiseptic or something like that. Pacification is what the U.S. did to Vietnam, you might recall. Mm. The Vietnamese people obviously did not want to be pacified by bombs and napalm and all of that. It's Orwellian, the use of words like this to really think about the Israeli pacification of the West Bank, the Missouri State Police pacification of Ferguson, or the South Side of Chicago, or Bayview Hunters Point, or in this case, Division Street in San Francisco. Let's pacify those people. The phone number is, let's get to the point here, I'm supporting KPFA is a vital part of speaking truth to power. We let them get away with words like pacification if we sit back and just let it all happen. The phone number is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732. When you make a call and make a contribution to KPFA, you're voting with your hard-earned dollars to speak up and to support the voices that are speaking up and bringing this information to an American audience, which desperately needs to have it. We all need to have this information so that we will no longer be deluded into thinking pacification sounds so user-friendly.
And it's very well written. I read the whole book. It's really very easy to read. It's just very well done. Pacification has the word peace in it, pass, so how can you be against it? And it has a long history in colonial enterprises. I come from Algeria, where the French took almost 50 years to pacify the country.
Didn't work very well, as I recall.
Didn't work very well. It's a polite word for genocide.
You don't seem very passive to me.
So pacification, it's the conquest of the West in this country. It's the conquest of most of the world by a few European nations. And they always use the word pacification because it sounds so positive.
1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. I just want to mention that we have three of our listeners have banded together for a total of $700 in match. Susan, Gertrude, and Valerie. Thank you so much. $700 on the line. We have about 35 minutes to go, but we're going to hear another extensive portion of Dr. Halper's talk. Just want to read something that it was so interesting for me, that over the last couple of decades, Israel has become a leading exporter of security, surveillances, and military equipment, one of the top 10 exporters in a global market worth $2.5 trillion a year. I mean, that's quite a...
That's a chunk of change.
That's a chunk of change here. And Israel's share is, in 2012, was about $7 billion. I mean, for a little place, exporting that much. But as Jeff Halper correctly stated, that it is, Israel has become its own, has its own real-time military laboratory and testing ground with real-life targets and tragic consequences. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. We're going to hear another excerpt of Dr. Halper's talk about his book, War Against the People.
Capitalism, of course, has a built-in violence and inequality and exploitation and so on. So you need all the time, securitization, all the time being sure that everybody is under control, and policing and discipline. This is what war is all about, but it's kind of an invisible form of war. Because, again, it's every day, and you don't have battles, you don't have big weapons like war. But in fact, war is policing, and policing today is war, certainly a class war. And that's why you have this idea that we know the police are being militarized. I mean, people are talking about the police being militarized. And you see the military out in the streets even. But one of the things we're not seeing is how the militaries are being policified. Militaries are being sent today not so much to fight wars, but they're being fought to do nation building, regime change, intervening in civil wars in different ways, peacekeeping operations, right? So there's much more police functions than war functions. So that this is an invisible, not very sexy, but the most important way today in which the capitalist system is enforcing its hegemony over the world system. And then you've got framing, what I call framing, based on security. And that is for most people, again, that don't feel the water, just living certainly in neoliberalism, you have a whole tendency of people becoming individualistic, very personalized, and not seeing the big picture. I think if we're not talking about capitalist world systems, it's because neoliberalism doesn't allow you to think big, to think in terms of other people and other systems. It's atomizing like that. So you internalize the system. That's where the water disappears. And it has to do, of course, with ideology and patriotism and education, religion, the media, all of that. But the point is that it's based on security. So our countries are being turned into security states, where security becomes the overriding issue. Everything is subsumed to security. And of course, with security then, the governments and the powers that be have the ability to declare a state of emergency. And the state of emergency becomes permanent. France, I'd be surprised if after 3 months they end the state of emergency in France. Israel's been in a state of emergency since 1948. The United States has been in a state of emergency since 9/11. If you go to Kennedy Airport, you walk in and there's a big thermometer that shows you the alert level. And it's always red. Sometimes on July 4th, it might go down to orange. But it's basically always red. So, and of course, the idea of a state of emergency is fear is constant. And you can suspend all the democratic protections that you have for the sake of security. So framing becomes very, very important. What's interesting, I don't want to get into this too much, but I think it's important for us to begin, even for our own work, to begin to articulate how our work and our different campaigns fit into this wider global system. Because in the end, if we can't convey a bigger picture to people, you can convince people that drones aren't good and you should boycott the SodaStream, and women should have equal rights. Okay. But what the major problems come from, you can't convey to people unless you can articulate this bigger system. So basically what's happened is, I think, until World War II, you had an expanding capitalism with imperialism. Certainly through World War II, and a little bit until the end of the Cold War. This was an expanding capitalist system. And so it went from military operations, because what it was doing was conquering lands and peoples. It was the colonialization and opening markets. And then, of course, once you colonized, you had to police them. So you have the Palestinian police, the Indian police in India. You take the natives and you make them the policemen over their own people. At the same time, capitalizing them, bringing the markets in, and replacing their cultures with a market-based lifestyle, value system, and so on. And then, of course, the framing was less important in the days of colonization. You didn't have to explain colonialism very much. It was far away, and they were enemies, or they were primitive, and so. So the whole system went from military this way. Today, where we're in this post-war capitalism, capitalism won, in a sense. It's conquered the world. There's nowhere in the world that isn't already brought in one way or another into the capitalist system. Today, it's going the other direction. So when we're trying to fight capitalism, it's not that we're fighting colonialism so much anymore, but we're fighting a much more vague. We're trying to tell people that they're being securitized, that they're being brainwashed, that they're being atomized and everything else, and exploited, and without them thinking it, without them feeling that, because they've already internalized that system. So it becomes much harder. And of course, what it all is based on today, or largely, is consumerism on the one hand, but security. And everybody wants security. So part of the language that we have to use to reframe for people what's really happening is to do away with the word security. The word security is a bad word for us. It feeds us into the system. As long as we talk about security, we're buying into the way they're trying to present. Who doesn't want security? Of course I want security. And who's going to bring me security? My government. So it's good that they got soldiers wandering the streets with big guns, because that's for my security. If we reframe this in terms of pacification, and that's not a word we use very often in the left. Now, pacification, this is the problem, means something different in English than it does in French, I think. Even in Sweden, it was something different. Pacification has maybe the connotation of, yeah, everybody being peaceful and nice and so on. In English, pacification means suppressing a population to the point where they can't resist it. In that sense, if we can start to use terms like that, now, I want to be secure. Do I want to be pacified? You see, and that begins to raise critical issues. Who's pacifying me? Why are they pacifying me? How are they pacifying me? Questions that don't arise if you're using words like security. And that gets you into policing, because this is the way the capitalist system today is enforcing its hegemony. And in fact, the military that we tend to focus on is the least relevant. You don't use the military. The military, like I said, is today used as more of a threat. It's used in a very sporadic sort of a way. And then when it's used, like in Syria, it's not used very effectively. Because, in fact, the military arsenals are not equipped for fighting the kinds of wars that are fought today. We're focusing, even on the left sometimes, on the wrong issue. We're focusing on military when we should be focusing on pacification, in my view. Pacification within a capitalist system, it's not a very easy thing to sell or to communicate. How do you campaign for that? You know, I don't know. But that's, in a sense, the issue in all of this. Going back to Israel, Israel feeds into this very well. You know, Israel's a small country. It can't produce major ships, submarines, F-35, jet fighters. It can't produce those kinds of weapons. So what it does, and this is a term that's used by the Ministry of Defense, it does niche them in military security police in the world. In other words, it looks at the whole world. What I mean is, there's three levels, maybe. One is the global north. Israel has fought 5 or 6 conventional wars. It's very sophisticated with high-tech weapon systems. So it's able to work with NATO. It's able to work with the European. It's developing the Watchkeeper drone, which is going to be the new European drone, which is an Elbit drone. It works very closely with the U.S. and so on. So on that level, it's very much a leader technologically in the global north in conventional military things. You've heard of the BRICS. It's kind of a counter-hegemonic bloc. Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa are the BRICS countries. But now they've added to that, economic analysts and others, another bloc that are called the MINT countries, which is Mexico, Indonesia, Nigeria, and Turkey. So if you take BRICS and MINT together, you have a very powerful bloc, a counter-hegemonic bloc beginning to arise. Well, Israel is super strong in every single one of those BRICS-MINT countries. So you begin to understand with security politics, when you get into the world of military security, it bypasses ideologies. That's its strength. So that, on the one hand, here Israel is an ally of the United States. Netanyahu goes every 3 weeks to talk to the American Congress. But Israel is the number 2 or 3 largest arms supplier to China. Well, China is the arch rival of the United States. They're moving the whole Sixth Fleet into the Pacific. And here's Israel after Russia, and France is in there as well, the number two or three arms supplier to China. Where's loyalty? They see there's no signs now. Israel is number three or four arms supplier to India. So Israel's the number two or three arms supplier to two of the largest militaries in the world. Not to mention, I can go on, Nigeria, Brazil. With security politics, you bypass ideology. But with security politics, you also create a common interest around military control. I mean, all elites, all ruling classes and political elites want to keep control. That's a common interest. So if you can feed that, what does it matter if it's Chinese or Indian or American or Belgium? It's the same interest. It's the same. They all want your arms and your security. You can deliver for everybody. So that you get a situation where the arms bypass ideologies. India was always pro-Palestinian. And Nigeria, strongly pro-Palestinian. But in the current situation, after the attacks on Mumbai, particular, and with Boko Haram in Nigeria, Israel is filling the niche. That's the point. Israel looks over the world and it sees what niches does the global north have, do the BRICS mid countries have, and then there's a third level, and that's the entire global south. I mean, Israel is everywhere. You say Equatorial Guinea, Peru. I mean, you go over the map, and it's very hard to find a country where Israel isn't strongly present, including Arab countries. It's not documented an Israel-Saudi military connection, although we know that Israel's been involved in the war in Yemen. And we know that Israel and Saudi Arabia are very close politically. They both have interests against the Shia. They both have interests against the new Arab Spring breaking out. And if you remember, the Arab Peace Initiative in 2002 was formulated by Saudi Arabia. It was a Saudi peace initiative. Now, Saudi would not have done that if Israel couldn't deliver, if Israel wasn't a military security power. There's no other reason why Saudi Arabia should be a friend of Israel. Normal international relations, we couldn't explain that. But if you put the military security into the picture, a whole different way of looking at the world begins to emerge. I would argue that Israel has more global reach in terms of the military and security than the United States does. You know, it sounds crazy. The Pentagon's budget is $1 trillion a year. They have 174 military bases around the world. Israel only has two military bases, both in Muslim countries. It's interesting. One in Eritrea and one in Azerbaijan, which is a great jump off to Iran when you need it. Otherwise, they don't have bases. But Israel is everywhere, not only militarily. You see, the Americans have bases, but they're military bases. So they're all based on McDonald's, but you don't feel them in your country, the American bases. Israel has not only trains militaries all over, but it trains your presidential guard, your special operations unit, your security forces, your police forces. So Israel's penetration into a country is much deeper than that of the Americans.
And that's the voice of prominent anthropologist, Palestinian rights activist and the author of War Against the People, Israel, the Palestinians, and Global Pacification. Philip, you were shaking your head.
Well, when I heard Israel had bases in Eritrea and Azerbaijan, I thought, what? What?
Well, they manage. 1-800-439-5732.
I learned something. You know, this is Jeff Harper is astounding. He is amazing. And he puts together information that I certainly didn't know and that I think everybody should know. And that's why I'm very enthusiastic about encouraging people this afternoon to go to their phones and get the entire speech. We're only, I think, Malia, you said it's two hours.
Two hours.
Yeah, and we've heard probably 40 30 minutes of
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
And so, believe me, we've heard a quarter of it. You'll have a chance to hear the whole thing with your contribution of $50 right now. $50 gets you the – it probably is two CDs because I think one
yes,
CD
it is, yeah.
one CD can't hold 2 hours. So the phone number is 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-KPFA. And then there's the book. For a $100 pledge, getting them both together for $140 would be totally great. And you mentioned earlier, Malihe, that this is a matching period. So
yes.
That makes it even doubly important that we, in fact, raise $700 ASAP. So
and we have not made it so far, Philip.
Yeah.
We have not. 1-800-439-5732. I know we're going to take 15 minutes to ask you for your support. This is the last week that we are coming to you. Of course, KPFA's fund drive is going to continue for another week
right.
or so. I think it'll end next Friday. Am I right?
A week from this Friday, yes.
A week from this Friday. 1-800-439-5732. This is really important information because when we often, Khalil, we've done shows on these huge systems of control, on military, on dictatorships, on a state repression. Sometimes it becomes really humongous, and we say, how can we crack this? But it's so interesting, in his book, he says that to a certain extent, if you start really removing support for Israel, for example, through BDS movement, mm-hmm. you start seeing changes. So even though what we are hearing sounds monumental. U.S. spends, what, some $600 billion on its military spending is $600 billion, and much of its built goes to all these countries like Saudi Arabia and the Gulf countries. But at the same time, it is us as citizens that have the power to change these relations. And I think that's where KPFA comes from. And I hope you support us so we continue with this message, this education and this connection with you, our listeners. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Philip, we have gotten some pledges online for the CD. Which I think that means it's resonating with some of our listeners. So I hope more of you go to your phone, dial 1-800-439-5732 or kpfa.org. Get Jeff Halper's book. It has so many pictures of all these strange, really, very strange equipments, military equipments and sensors, and which I think is really interesting. And he goes through each one of them in detail, what they are, when they were developed, what they're used for. So it's quite a comprehensive and, as Khalil said, one-of-a-kind book. 1-800-439-5732, the talk for a pledge of 52 CD set, the book for 100, the combo for 140, 1-800-439-5732.
I want to thank a few people who've sent in their pledges. Antonio Ruiz in Oakland. Thank you, Antonio. Robert Mansanedo in Fresno. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Barbara Coleman in San Jose. Thank you very much.
You've got one more there, don't you?
Yes. 1-800-439-5732. I'm going to go and check and see if you have made the match.
No.
Philip, we shouldn't? No. I shouldn't check?
No. they'll come and tell us. Believe me, we need you in the studio.
Yes. 1-800-439-5732.
Also, Marla and Bill Decker and Visalia. Thank you very much.
I think that what's not made clear in people's minds is that Israel has become an expert on operating a police state. And I only have been in Israel and the occupied territories once, and it was 26 years ago. It was 1990.
The whole place is occupied, Philip.
I know. My information, I have a hunch things have only gotten worse in the last 26 years. But it was a police state then. And by operating a police state ever since 1967 in West Bank and Gaza, we're talking about a military that has become expert in operating prisons and operating roadblocks and operating detention of people, of operating inquisitions, of questioning, of torturing. And they are the world's experts at all of this. And so now they're marketing it as a capitalist enterprise. You want to operate a police state? Well, let's go to the people that really know how to operate a police state. We're talking about the Israelis.
And they're proud of it. And actually, their experience goes back even further to 1948 when they started the occupation. And they had 20%. They have 20% of their population that's Arab-Palestinian. And those people were under occupation, and they were being controlled. So the expertise goes back almost 70 years.
1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. You would really are going to benefit from listening to the two-hour lecture by Jeff Halper. And what I think he has done, which is very, very interesting, that he talks about the emergence and continuity and transformation of capitalism and the security system together, mm-hmm. especially after World War II, that it has become much more intrusive, it has become much more intricate, and that example of the fish, I think it's very telling. We live in it, but we necessarily don't feel it. I mean, we have mobile devices, we have been listened to, we have been tracked, we have been exposed to so many different matrices of control that he enumerates and details in this book. 1-800-439-5732. Thank you so much for that pledge online at kpfa.org.
I also want to mention that, in fact, what we're talking about here is the word security. Everybody wants security, and I'm thinking of the Super Bowl week or 10 days, whatever it was, where downtown San Francisco was an occupied city with more different paramilitary outfits than ever imagined, carrying machine guns on the streets of San Francisco. We're talking about it being an armed camp.
California Dreaming.
Yes. it's not a dream, it's a nightmare. It's really a nightmare. And, I mean, actually, it's an opportunity for all of these paramilitaries to try out their toys.
Yeah.
And boys with toys. They were loving it.
I mean, Super Bowl. Super Bowl 50.
That's what we've been talking about.
Yeah, exactly. So I defied your demand.
You went back to the phone
and
room
I went
found
back
out.
To the phone. And thank you so much. So many of you are calling. Again, I don't know if we've made the match because of
That's why you went back there was
Philip.
To find out if
I
we made
I came back
them.
Really fast. But I hope you do call us. And it seems like the phone, there are only five people in our pledge room, and they're all busy taking your calls. So please do call back. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. I am not going to leave your site, Philip. Stay here.
Okay, well, let's just remind people, this match has been put up by three women, which I think is significant as well. Susan in Moraga, Gertrude at Kentfield, and wait for this, Valerie in Waialuku, Hawaii.
Oh, wow.
Aloha, Valerie.
Aloha, Valerie.
Thank you so much. So, I think this is the first time we're getting a call or a pledge from Hawaii. 1-800-439-5732.
If we're nice to Valerie, she might offer us the couch in her living room or something.
We'll take it. 1-800-439-5732. And it won't be Airbnb.
No.
It will be legit.
Okay.
1-800-439-5732. In his book, he says you've got 4.5 million Palestinians in the occupied territory that you can test these weapons and security devices on. And that's what's given Israel this cutting edge in the market. So that if you insert that, the whole world looks different. All of a sudden, countries that seem to be your enemies are your friend. There's all kind of interest that come out, and it has as he gave some examples in his talk. 1-800-439-5732.
Just something like, again, my experience is 26 years old, but it hasn't changed. On the West Bank, there are different license plates. Mm-hmm. Palestinians have one license plate.
Yes.
Israelis have another license plate. If you have an Israeli license plate, you get to go on these highways that go all across the West Bank to all these settlements all over the place. If you have Palestinian plates on your vehicle, you can't go on those roads. And so people from South Africa are comparing Israel-Palestine with apartheid in South Africa, and they're blown away. There's no way in South Africa, under the deepest, darkest apartheid, that black people weren't allowed to drive on roads, you know, whole road system that you can't drive on.
Jewish-only roads.
Yeah.
1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732 or kpfa.org. Wow, thank you so much. We just got a $240 pledge online.
Fabulous.
Thank you so very much. This means a lot.
Well,
because
it's doubled. It's 480.
Yes. And I think this is such a timely conversation to have. We are in the midst of a very bizarre, to say the least, election, and everybody is trying to overdo the next person by talking about, except Bernie, increasing military spending and being
more bellicose security.
Being more kind of this warmongering rhetoric. And I still think that the American society and American people in general are the people that are not going to let this country slip into darkness, a total darkness.
I mean,
I hope so.
Donald Trump.
1-800-439-57. Don't bring up that name.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I won't refer to him by name, but DT, what did he say? A ban on all Muslims. Really?
No, we'll be around. Khalil and I will be around.
Really?
At least he didn't call Muslims rapists and murderers. Yes.
That's reserved for Mexicans.
1-800-439-5732.
I'm sure that Donald has plans for you.
1-800-439-5732. There is nowhere for us to escape to.
Every day he has to come up with something. Give him a break. So he gets all this free publicity. Even
we're giving him publicity right now.
1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439. It's a matching period, and I do not know if we have made that match. 1-800-439-5732.
But you went back to the phone room to find out, and you didn't find anything.
No, I didn't. The phones were ringing, and I just rushed back.
Okay.
1-800-439-5732. We have about 3 minutes, I think.
3 minutes.
If I'm not mistaken. So you still have a chance to go to your phones, 1-800-439-5732, and pledge for Jeff's book, $100, or his 2-CD set lecture for a pledge of $50, and the combo, as some of you have done, I guess, for a pledge of $140. This is an immense amount of information. Of course, you can become a sustainer. You can pledge to KPFA, and you can pay $5 a month, $2 a month, whatever amount. It really doesn't matter. I think what matters is that we want you to support KPFA, and we want you to stay with KPFA. 1-800-439-5732. Are we going to
particularly Valerie and Waialuku, we want to stay
yes.
with KPFA.
And we want to stay connected, Valerie. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732.
Get in under the wire. Come on. This is the crunch. This is the crunch time. It's now or never. Please go to the phone. 1-800-439-5732. Are you going to hear a program like this on any other station up and down the dial? Are you really going to hear this really somewhere else? I don't think so. Realize that the difference is worth supporting.
1-800-439-5732. Again, this is the last time we are coming to you. We have about a minute and a half left, or even less. So I hope you help us not only get to $700 match, but also surpass it. 1-800-439-5732. One thing that I like about Jeff Halper, that his argument is not formalistic and legalistic. It's a moral argument. And that's what he says. He says, Israel is a very immoral country. They are willing to sell it to sell their weapons to anybody. But companies are starting to really not invest in Israel or pull their businesses out. Viola has pulled out, and there are other companies. Why? Because BDS movement. So in some ways, forces against the occupation also have become globalized. 1-800-439-5732.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Fukushima, 5 years later. If you followed the internet news on the unfolding disaster that began in Fukushima on 11, 2011, you are familiar with one voice for sure, Arne Gundersen of Fair Winds Associates. He brought all the important detail of the operation of nuclear power plants into the discussion. Gundersen is a licensed reactor operator and managed and coordinated projects at 17 nuclear power plants in the U.S. After 20 years as nuclear engineer and executive, Gundersen was fired from his job with Nuclear Energy Services in 1990. When he became a whistleblower on the lack of nuclear safety. Gundersen served as an expert witness in the investigation of the Three Mile Island accident and testified on the serious flaws of the Vermont Yankee, San Onofre, and Diablo Canyon nuclear power plants. Both Vermont Yankee and San Onofre are now in shutdown. In 2008, Gundersen's wife Maggie formed the nonprofit Fair Winds Energy Education. Their website features videos and podcasts, as well as blog posts on current events, expert witness reports on nuclear safety issues, a book list, media coverage, and much more. The website is widely used in Japan, and thanks to dedicated volunteer translators, is available in 4 languages. And this radio program gives you a sense of the work done through that website. On the 5th anniversary of the Fukushima accident, Arne Gundersen is spending a month in Japan to assess the status of the cleanup and follow-up. He comes to Japan at a very crucial moment, even though polls show that at least 70% of Japanese do not want the nuclear power plants reopened that were shut down 5 years ago. The Abe government is determined to put many of them back online and has begun the process. And to make things worse, the Japanese government is planning to burn plutonium mixed with uranium in the aging reactors, a practice that has been abandoned in the U.S. due to the high risk. Gundersen was invited to speak to community groups and NGOs across Japan. He's traveling with a group of scientists and a representative of NIRS, the Nuclear Information and Resource Service. Mary Olson plans to focus on the health effects on women and children. All research and experience show that women and children are especially vulnerable to radiation. As I'm preparing this radio program for broadcast, Gundersen and Olson have arrived in Japan at the first stop, Fukushima Prefecture. Like all visitors to the area, they came equipped with their own Geiger counters. Gundersen spoke with Maggie Gundersen at Fair Winds to phone in his first report. He had taken the bullet train to Fukushima City and drove by car to some of the ghost towns that surround the power plant.
I'll tell you, the devastation's just awful. You go by beautiful homes, and they're abandoned. You know, there's snow in the mountains, and there's, you know, the driveways aren't plowed, and the places are beginning to get run down. And in their front yard, you'll see dozens of bags, and each bag weighs a ton filled with dirt. There's 30 million bags weighing 30 million tons of radioactive dirt and radioactive tree leaves and everything. And then, of course, all the rice paddies are loaded with plastic bags full of radioactive material, so they're not going to be, you know, growing rice there for a long time. Then we found a parking lot at a supermarket that had a large radioactive source right in the middle of the parking lot that people were walking over and driving over. It was loaded with a black radioactive dust. So just wherever you go, it's everywhere. And every house we saw was abandoned. Then you get into a small town that is open during the day for the construction people. And then they close down when the construction people leave. Wherever you go, there's constant reminders that everything's radioactive. Big orange signs on the side of the road saying, you know, this area is not under construction, but this area is being decontaminated. Then we go to areas that were complete, and they're radioactive as all heck. So as soon as they clean it, it rains and it becomes contaminated again.
Why is that? Why does the rain bring it in again? Is that washing down from the mountains or the hillsides, or is that washing from the site, or is it radioactivity still exuding from the site that's being redeposited?
Well, they're only cleaning 20 feet on every side of the road. So all the dust and debris that's up in the forests is being blown by the wind or washed by the rain right into people's front yards again. One of the samples that one of my fellow scientists collected showed plutonium and significant amounts of plutonium. He was getting 19 disintegrations per second of plutonium. And, you know, that stuff hangs around for a quarter of a million years.
That plutonium was part of the core that came out then in the explosion, correct?
Yeah. The only source it could ever have come from was inside that nuclear reactor. Fukushima City is relatively clean. It's 40 miles away from the site. So I'm with three carloads of scientists, and as we left Fukushima City, their radiation detectors were reading about 40 counts per minute. And then as we got into the hills between Fukushima City and the power plant, the radiation detectors went up to 400, 10 times what it was in the city. And there's heavy snow everywhere. There's at least a foot of snow in the mountains. So that's acting as shielding and preventing these numbers from even being higher. We went out to a incinerator. It's under construction. And they plan to burn 10 tons a day of material. Well, there's 30 million tons of material up here. So that means they'll have it all done in 3 million days. That's a long, 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 long time. 1,000 years.
1,000 years?
Yeah, this incinerator's not working yet, but their throughput is estimated to be 10 tons a day. All of those particles are up there in the hills, and there's no way that any number of human beings could go up into an entire mountainside. Some of these mountains are 8,000 feet high. So, to go up into them and clean a mountain range is just beyond the capability of human beings. So what happens is every time it snows or every time it rains, it washes down into these villages and it washes down into the Pacific. In these hills around Fukushima, there's monkeys. And we saw one today, as a matter of fact, running across the road. And one of the scientists watched the monkey poop and then collected the poop. And the monkey poop had 50,000 becquerels per kilogram of cesium in it. So, you know, these animals that are living up there in the forests are becoming more and more and more highly radioactive. You know, the impression I get is the futility of the cleanup. I mean, these areas that scientists I'm with sampled today were supposedly clean, and they're highly radioactive again. this deep sadness of seeing these beautiful family homes just abandoned and likely to remain abandoned for a lifetime. So the futility and the sadness, I think, are the two things that weigh on me the most as I go to bed tonight.
That was part of the first phoned-in report by Arne Gundersen. He is on a one-month journey to Japan to assess the status of the cleanup of the Fukushima accident. From here, he will travel on to Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Kobe, Kyoto, and the Osaka Global Environmental Forum. Gundersen is chief engineer of Fairwinds Associates and on the board of directors for Fairwinds Energy Education. That's a 501c3 nonprofit. Just before leaving for Japan, Arne Gundersen sat down with the staff of Fairwinds Energy Education, his wife Maggie, and Toby Aronson and Caroline Phillips. They went over the information that is so crucial in understanding the current situation in Japan. First, here's Arne Gundersen addressing the claim by TEPCO that the cleanup of the land around the Fukushima power plants is well underway, facilitating a possible return of some of the evacuated residents.
The country's seriously contaminated even now. People that live in the prefecture are living in what we would call an RCA, and that stands for a radiologically contaminated area. If that were in the States, if that were in a nuclear power plant, those kinds of levels of radiation would require that you couldn't walk into those areas without health physics support.
Currently, there are a lot of people who are dislocated, but are people also returning to these contaminated areas as well right now?
Yeah, I think they're being forced to go back in. You got to remember, there's 160,000 people that were evacuated originally, and now the number's just a hair under 100,000. So 60,000 have gone back into areas that we would consider, by United States standards, highly contaminated. But what the Japanese did was they raised the standards, and they took away the money from these people when they were in housing, not in the prefecture. So they said, if you want to continue with the stipend we have you on, you've got to go home. So it's basically they're forcing them back into an area that's much more radioactive than it was when they left.
So, Arne, not only are people moving back into contaminated areas, but we also have some nuclear power plants in Japan starting up again. Can you talk about some concerns regarding that issue?
Yeah, Toby, that's a great question. You know, there were 54 nuclear power plants in Japan operating right before the Great East Earthquake and the disaster at Fukushima Daiichi. Well, there were four units at Daiichi wiped out, plus there were two others that will never start again. Plus, there were four others just down the road at Fukushima Daini. So 10 nuclear reactors will essentially never operate again because they're in Fukushima Prefecture. In addition, at least another 10 or 15 are too old to operate and should have been shut down even before the earthquake. So that 54 units has tumbled down to about 26. Of those 26, the Japanese are frantically trying to get them back up and running. And the real reason behind it all is, you've heard it before, money. The banks have put a lot of money into maintaining those 26 power plants and paying for the staffs to sit there essentially idle for the last 5 years. They want their money back. And the only way to get their money back is to turn those nukes back on. So what's happened in the last 5 years is that the Japanese haven't really made these plants any stronger. What they've done is they've reanalyzed all of their calculations and taken away all the margins of safety and said that, well, a stronger earthquake, these plants can withstand. But in fact, there's been no major changes to the structure. It's frightening. You know, these plants were built by people my age when we got out of college in the 70s. They're old. And the Japanese refuse to acknowledge that it was a bad bet then, and they're going to double down on a bad bet now. The Abe regime is very pro-business, and the banks have deep inroads into the Abe regime. And on top of that, the 10 utilities that run all of the power grid in Japan are little fiefdoms that have incredible pressure in their parliament diet. So politically, the pressure from the banks, the pressure from these 10 power companies, Tokyo Electric is only one of 10, and the Abe regime are totally ignoring what the public wants. And you're right, it's at least 70% of the Japanese, including almost every woman and just about half the men, don't want nuclear power to operate again. But it's being ramrodded through by financial interests that just don't care about public health and safety.
When there were no nuclear reactors in Japan going, I never read about any blackouts or power outages. And my question is, how is Japan meeting its energy needs without all of the nuclear reactors that haven't been restarted or will not be restarted? Are they necessary?
Yeah, there's a couple of answers to that, Caroline. It's a great question. The first is that the Japanese power grid is really nowhere near a world power grid. They have 10 little fiefdoms, and they don't share power across the grid. So you've got TEPCO to the north and Chubu to the south of Tokyo, and each has an enormous overcapacity in case one unit goes down. In the United States, we have a shared grid. We pool our power. In Japan, they don't. Matter of fact, in western Japan, they're at 50 cycles per second, and in eastern Japan, they're at 60 cycles per second. So they can't even agree on how many cycles per second the electricity should flow at. So when all these units shut down, there's a lot of excess capacity sitting around anyway. And it was largely gas and largely coal. So what happened is two things. First, and the Japanese really deserve an enormous amount of credit, they conserved like crazy. They really went on an efficiency kick. I was in office buildings where the temperature inside was 78 in the summer. And it wasn't bad. You know, they realized that they were overcooling in the summer and overheating in the winter. So the Japanese really went into an energy efficiency and a conservation mode. They did import more coal and gas. And then they also brought in the equivalent of about 6 nuclear power plants worth of solar power. So they're beginning already to displace with solar power these old nukes. And you're right, there were no blackouts. Tokyo remained well over-illuminated, trust me. And life went on.
Arnie, I have a follow-up question to that. You touched on solar. What is the actual progress with renewables?
Well, there's enormous pressure by these 10 utilities that we talked about. You know, the 10 governing electric boards, essentially, are putting enormous pressure on the diet so that renewables are being stifled. But even despite that, people are doing it, and corporations are doing it. You know, the interesting thing is that even before the disaster at Fukushima Daiichi, Japan had the highest electrical rates in the industrial world. And that's an incredible burden. And now they're going to be higher because they just, you know, paid for 5 years of nuclear plants that didn't run, and they want that money back too. So electric costs in Japan are arbitrarily high because these 10 powerhouse utilities control the diet, control the parliament, and the people are getting stuck with high rates. So now we've got high rates that they pay for out of their wall socket, and they're realizing, heck, I can go off the grid and put a solar collector on and get it cheaper. So they've priced themselves to a point where new solar is much, much cheaper than what they can get from the grid. And the big industries are realizing it too. The big industries are building their own power plants or building their own solar collectors so that they don't have to pay these exorbitant rates that the Japanese are being charged.
Arnie, moving on to issues regarding the outpour of radiation into the Pacific Ocean, there's been a lot of debate on exactly how contaminated is the Pacific Ocean. Is it affecting our food? Is it affecting our water quality?
Yeah, Toby, the Japanese are focusing on leaks from the Fukushima power plants. And, you know, that's probably a mile of coastline, and it is severely contaminated, and it continues to bleed into the Pacific every day. But what no one is paying any attention to is that the entire mountain range that runs 100 miles up and down this coast is also contaminated. And as much radiation is pouring out into the rivers and streams, into the Pacific from the mountain range because it's so contaminated, as from the Fukushima site. So, you know, Tokyo Electric would have you just look at the site and say, well, we're doing things to collect the radiation. But in fact, they've got an entire state pouring radiation into the Pacific. So what's in the Pacific? Off of California, they're finding radiation at what I would consider significant levels. A cubic meter is about 3 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet. And in a cubic meter of ocean water, they're finding 10 radioactive decays every second. That's called the disintegration. So that's called 10 becquerels per cubic meter. So a cubic meter of water, if you were in a dark room, would have 10 flashes of light every second. And that's going to go on for 300 years. So we have contaminated the biggest source of water on the planet, and there's no way to stop it.
So are you saying that the contaminated water problem is hopeless?
It used to be that scientists believed dilution is the solution to pollution. But I think we're finding with the biggest body of water on the planet that you can't dilute this stuff. And we're going to begin to see this bioaccumulation, which is all the fish that are in the ocean are going to uptake the cesium and the strontium and become more and more and more radioactive.
Arnie used the term bioaccumulation. If you could explain to our audience what exactly that means and sort of what that implies as far as, you know, food quality goes or water quality.
Well, if you think of it as there's radiation on the bottom of the Pacific, and that gets picked up by the whatever's on the bottom, the seaweed. And then little fish eat the seaweed, and little fish get eaten by bigger fish, and those fish get eaten by still bigger fish.
Circle of life.
Right. You know, and that process, every time they do that, the cesium in the little fish gets concentrated in the bigger fish. It's not just radioactivity. We know that about the mercury that's in tuna. The coal plants have thrown mercury out into the oceans, and it works its way up the food chain, too. So this concept of bioaccumulation doesn't just apply to radiation, but it is applying to fish in the food chain now.
I know that I haven't heard anything announced by the FDA, and I'm not a believer that the FDA would automatically say anything, but I know we don't have any substantiated radio levels in our seafood coming to the United States, but what is your stance? Do you eat out and take Maggie out to sushi regularly for bits of yellowfin tuna?
You know, the FDA limit is so high. It's 12 times higher for Americans than what it is for Japanese. So basically, if the Japanese find a fish that they can't eat, they can ship it to America and feed it to us, and the FDA doesn't care. So we've got a really high threshold. And on top of that, the FDA is hardly sampling fish at all. Less than a tenth of a percent of the fish that come into the United States are tested. Really, really small number. So my decision is I'm not eating fish from the Pacific. That's a personal decision. I never did eat yellowfin tuna, by the way, because they're such a beautiful fish. I just really couldn't stand, you know, killing one.
Arnie, while you're in Japan, I know that a number of presentations are set for you and you'll be traveling all over. In your presentations, what are you specifically talking about to these groups?
Yeah, the first thing I'll be talking about in Japan is the use of plutonium in their nuclear reactors for fuel. They call that MOX, a mixed oxide fuel, but it's uranium and plutonium together inside a nuclear reactor. Running a reactor on plutonium is, one, really technically complicated, and two, expensive. There's not a reactor in America that uses MOX fuel, and there's none in the pipeline either. Why? Because our utilities are trying to minimize the cost, and it's actually cheaper to use uranium than it is for mixed oxide fuel. In Japan, they don't care. You know, as we talked about at the beginning here, the utilities that own these power plants have control over the rates. So they're paying more for this plutonium fuel. In America, not a power plant in the country uses plutonium for fuel because it's more complicated to license. And after a nuclear accident, it also complicates the accident analysis. So it's a real mess using plutonium. And I really want to talk about how I think it's a bad decision that plutonium will be used in Japanese reactors.
What do you think is the terrorist risk with MOX reactors?
You know, there's some brilliant people, and Frank von Hippel is probably at the top of the list at Princeton, who have been saying for 20 and 30 years that having plutonium driving down the highways to fuel a power plant is a real terrorist risk. And the reason is that if you capture a truck that's got plutonium and uranium in it, you can chemically separate out the plutonium and make a bomb. You don't need a real fancy gaseous diffusion plant and billions of dollars. You can chemically pull out the plutonium and make a bomb.
That was a conversation with Arne Gundersen that included Maggie Gundersen and staff at Fairwinds Energy Education. As a young man, Gundersen believed in the promise of nuclear power. He was a licensed reactor operator and managed projects at 70 nuclear power plants in the U.S. However, he became increasingly more aware of the high risks while at the same time observing serious safety breaches. He spoke out and became a whistleblower. After 20 years as nuclear engineer and executive, Gundersen was fired from his job in 1990. My thanks to Fairwinds and Maggie and Arne Gundersen for the material in this radio program that was recorded by them in February 2016. You can find the full podcast of their conversation and the phone calls from Japan on the website of fairwinds.org. That's Fairwinds with an E, F-A-I-R-E, winds.org. Fairwinds website has information on uranium mining and fuel, design and construction, decommissioning of nuclear power plants, and on waste and spent fuel. The Gundersens are also reaching out to many other experts with interviews and references to their work. You can subscribe to podcasts on their page, fairwinds.org. Come back for TUC Radio's next broadcast for an up-close interview of Arne and Maggie Gundersen. I finally met them in person when they came to California for a November 2015 speaking tour. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. Our email address is tuc@tucradio.org. Time of useful consciousness is an aeronautical term. It's the time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for useful projects to rescue the planet and the plane. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
There are other scientific systems that do not comply with the Western scientific method. We need an inter-scientific dialogue happening between modern culture, the modern civilization, and our ancestral mature culture. They will gain enormously if they do that. But they have to abandon arrogance, and they have to abandon fear to do that. And that those teachings, they are in the teachings I mentioned previously from the Anishinaabe people. You have to be humble and you have to be courageous, which are the contrary of fear and arrogance.
That's the voice of Elder and University of Ottawa Professor Marcelo Saavedra. On this week's show, we speak to Marcelo in the second part of a three-part series called Regenerative Ways of Being. So stay tuned.
We are speaking with Dr. Marcelo Saavedra. He is a professor of Indigenous Studies at the University of Ottawa. He's also an Aymara elder, and we reached him in Ottawa. I would like us to focus on the life-giving practices that were given to us by our ancestors. There are many ways the wisdom of our elders have already instructed a path for us to follow. For many indigenous people, whether it's the Anishinaabe, the Maya, the Aymara people, there's a set of instructions of wisdoms that we are called to practice in order to live a good life, a life that is in symbiotic reciprocity with the world. Can we talk a little bit about how do we cultivate, how do we reconnect to those roots?
Yeah. Here on Turtle Island, we are quite fortunate to have about 55 nations here in Canada. And that we have the wealth of wisdom of these 55 nations. Unfortunately, a number of them have disappeared, have gone extinct. Many of their languages have been eliminated. But we still have some important communities that belong to the Anishinaabe people, to Cree communities, to the Inuit Nation, to Mi'kmaq, and so on. We still have some sort of wealth in the wisdom of these nations. And they are close to us, you know. And every nation has a set of teachings and something that is common among all indigenous nations, that one of the fundamental teachings they have and by which they abide all the time is sharing. In my language, we say is hisanya. So sharing is the most important thing, because the hand that will always be full with things, with food, is the hand that is offering this food to others. So that's why we share. And if you approach an elder, they will share with you whatever you want to be shared. And I'll give you an example. I live here on Anishinaabe territory. And the teachings that we abide by, they come from the Anishinaabe nation. And we call them the teachings of the seven grandfathers. And these are Nibwak Kawin, which means wisdom. And by the way, from enunciating only one of these teachings, you can derive the other six of them, because they are related to each other. You have to have the predisposition of one of them if you are going to be open to the rest, and you'll see. The other teaching is Sagittivin, which means love. And again, these teachings, they are like reciprocal. So if you are loved, it's because you love. So, you know, you receive and you give. Then there is Minadenda Mawin, which means respect, which is implied by love and by wisdom. Then there is bravery, which in Algonquian we said Akodewin. Then there is honesty, which is Guayak Guadeswin. Then there is Dabadensiwin, which is humility. And the last one, which actually encompasses the other six teachings, is Dewewin, which means truth or truthfulness. So when you have attained the state in which you are being truthful by living these teachings, they have become part of who you are, then you are being truthful to yourself, first of all, to the community, to your ancestors, to your future generations, and to the Creator. So, you know, for instance, in my courses, because this is the protocol, I have to teach this to my students. And this is what I share with them, because this is Algonquin land, and they have to live by the teachings of the land. This teaching, they come right from the land, you know. And it is the elders that were able to read these teachings in the many hundreds or thousands of years that they have been interacting with the land. In my culture, we have other sets of teachings, you know, expressed differently in other languages and using other symbols and metaphors. But basically, they're all about this. It's been like respectful, it's been humble, it's been truthful, wise, and all the things that I mentioned before. So if you need to approach to the wisdom of this mature culture, you just, you know, you go about and find an elder, and I can assure you that this elder is going to be happy to be sharing this with you, because that's the spirit that moves us, sharing.
For many cultures, mature cultures, indigenous cultures, the idea that men and women have unique gifts that balance each other, that together contribute, you know, for the Taoist, the Yang and Yin, you know, are a relationship. Can we talk about the relationships that we must co-create in order to create a world and to be in co-creation of the worlds that we coexist within?
In my culture, we have this pair, which is the fundamental parity for us, which is the Chachawarmi, man-woman, no man and woman, but man-woman, just like one word. It's like a complementary opposing forces. They imply each other. It's like the, you mentioned the yin-yang. If you imagine the yin-yang, the yin, which is the black half of the symbol, has a white dot in the center. That's because the feminine part, the black part, implies the other part, the white part. That's why it has that white dot. So from that white dot, you can actually recreate the yang, the masculine part. And it's the same thing with the when man and woman. You can imply the other by looking at one of them, you know. And this is not an excluding exercise. You know, I have received this question many times in my courses from my students. How do we deal with people that have a different identity, not in terms of a gender, that although they are, let's say, there's a female, they have the personality or the identity of a male. So for us, we don't discriminate against people that have other gender, not the one that shows their body, and we call them two-spirited people. You know, and actually for us, they are special because they have two spirits. They have the male and the female spirit in one person. So we don't discriminate against them. We believe that they are quite special persons, very gifted by Mother Earth. So, and in our belief of living and coexisting well, it is important that we have the pair carrying this out. They have to execute the social project of having a community. It is crucial that they are together in equilibrium, walking through this path. Like, for instance, in my country, half of the legislators in the legislative power, they are women. Half of the ministers are women. And this is not because of feminist theory or affirmative action. No, this comes from our ancestral beliefs. After we have acknowledged that our ancestors were quite wise in their beliefs, then we managed to recuperate the notion of chachawarmi, which puts the woman in equilibrium with men and vice versa. So that's why we have like the two fundamental halves distributed equally in my country.
We cannot talk about co-creation without talking about the dystopian systems that co-create us in competition with each other. And when we think about capitalism, and you and I had had a conversation in the past where you describe it as this zombie, you know, this undead. It not only is corrosive in the way that it defines us in terms of monetizing life as a way of giving value. How should we understand our ways of creating not just societies, but the way that we understand these economies, you know, of understanding our sharing, because that's, you know, we are told it's inevitable that we're going to create a system, an economic system of some sort to trade and share our talents, our gifts.
According to the beliefs we have, Aymara people, as Quechua people, as Amazonian peoples, we are living through an age of what we call the Pachacuti, which translates into a cosmic upheaval. Things are being turned upside down. And we can see that clearly with the economic sphere, the financial sphere. Like in the, you know, when capitalism was just starting, you know, some decades before the Industrial Revolution, the markets were part of a community. A community had developed markets so they could meet there and they could exchange or barter products. So that was the function of the market, but it was a socially controlled entity, the market. Nowadays, it's upside down. The market controls society. Everything has to go by the market, to acquire value. And everything is being turned into commodities so they can be put into use. So the market has become like the central organism, or I should say machine, through which things have to go in order to become useful to society. And society doesn't have any control over the market. You know, we depend on the indices of the market to have like a decent life in this sort of system. And even worse, after the Second World War, they tried to reform the financial system. They created the Iron Triangle. That the Iron Triangle is the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Trade Organization. At the time, it was called GATT, the GATT, that eventually became the World Trade Organization. Well, we call them the Iron Triangle. And eventually they managed to separate the financial sphere from its economic temple. And the finances, they started to have a life of their own, and they started to create recessions everywhere. Like nowadays, we're in a profound recession that has begun like about the year 2003, and there was another crisis in 2008, and we're still in the same crisis. It's not a different one. It's the same crisis that is just undulating, and eventually it's going to burst, and it's going to provoke all kinds of social suffering, economic injustices, and is going to also try to reactivate itself by going again to other wars. Because that's how the system keeps on going, by going to war and to by creating more places in which war happens. And the social consequences, you can see that, you know, there's, I mean, a crisis of refugees that has never been like this since the Second World War. And it's going to get worse, because on top of that, we're going to have the climate change of refugees. So all these crises are being expressed in the other crises that are going to fire all the disarray and the suffering of people around the planet. And especially among them, it's indigenous people. You know, they are the first ones to suffer, because they are so close to the land that they really suffer when an environment is tampered with.
Among indigenous people, you know, we hear elders telling us about tracking, you know, how we track and become intimate with our path, with the path to live in awareness of the sacred. How do we find our way back in order to create this concentric circles, you know, meaning wholeness in our relationships?
In indigenous cultures, we have what we term a vision quest. So we try to have our younger generations go through fasting and vision quest at a relatively young age, so they can know, so they are aware of who they are and where they need to go. And many who have done this vision quest at an early stage, they become elders at a young age too. Like, for instance, I work with the elder Jacob Obati, who you know, He has become an elder when he was about 27 years old. He was young, but he became an elder because he became so aware of who he was and who, what his journey was, you know. And although not all of us can do a vision quest because we lack the guides and the mentors to do so, there are some other tools that come from other traditions that are quite useful. For instance, in the Buddhist tradition, you know, we contemplate silence because in silence we are going to find many answers and many questions as well. Even in the Christian tradition, we have to pray from the bottom of our hearts. The Muslim tradition, the same thing, you know, we have references to be good people, to comply with the precepts that have been left for us to live by our ancestors, including our prophets. And in many other traditions, like most of the cultures that populate the planet, they have their own religious traditions. So we have to get close to that because, like, according to our beliefs, the circle of life implies that all voices have to be heard. And there are so many voices on our planet. We just have to become humble, to open our heart, and to listen attentively and with full intention. And that's how we will awaken from this long nightmare of patriarchy, colonialism, and capitalism.
You know, among some of the gifts that I think are most generative are the gift of compassion, the gift of, you know, generous listening and empathy, you know, not just for ourselves and for where we are. Can we maybe talk about the way then that we heal our own sense of brokenness? I think a lot of the times the things that prevent us from having a path of wholeness is our own insecurities that we have cultivated of being unworthy, of being imperfect, of being broken somehow.
One of the things that Europeans brought to our land and that unfortunately we live by it in modern times, actually this thing is composed of two elements, fear and arrogance. Fear is embedded in the system, like for instance in economics, one of the first things that you learn in economics 101 is that resources on our planet are scarce. So scarcity is something that you are taught from the on, and economics is the science of scarcity. But scarcity causes you fear because you are afraid that eventually we are going to run out of things. And because we have that fear so ingrained in ourselves for hundreds of years now, it's happening. And the other thing is arrogance, that we have developed this sense of entitlement over everything. You know, we go to a parcel of land and we believe that it belongs to us. So we go there and we clean it up, like down, as I said before, down to bacterial level, and we build houses, we build malls, we develop it, as we call it. So that's arrogance. And arrogance also is shown in the way the Western mentality has been imposed onto everyone on the planet. And we believe that the Western mode of validating knowledge is the only way possible. And we have forgotten to see, and we have failed to see, that there are other scientific systems that do not comply with the Western scientific method. We need an inter-scientific dialogue happening between modern culture, the modern civilization, and our ancestral mature cultures. They will gain enormously if they do that. But they have to abandon arrogance, and they have to abandon fear to do that. And that those teachings, they are in the teachings I mentioned previously from the Anishinaabe people. You have to be humble and you have to be courageous, which are the contrary of fear and arrogance.
That was Marcelo Saavedra, and join us next week for the last part of our three-part series. I'm going to finish the show with a song by David Rovix, We Are Everywhere. Bye for now.
We should have food. I speak for many when I say no one should have seven homes. While some don't have any, though I may find myself stranded in some strange place with naught but a vapid stare, I remember the world and I know we are everywhere. Say the time for the rich, it will come. Let me count the ways, victories or hints of the future. Havana, Caracas, Chiapas, Buenos Aires. How many people are wanting and waiting and fighting for their share? They hide in their ivory towers, but we are everywhere. Religions and prisons and races, borders and nations, FBI agents and congressmen and corporate radio stations. They try to keep us apart, but we find each other, and the rulers are always aware that they're a tiny minority, and we are everywhere. With every bomb that they drop, every home they destroy, every land they invade, comes a new generation from under the rubble saying, we are not afraid. They will pretend we are few, but with each child that a billion mothers bear, comes the next demonstration that we are everywhere.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you and bye for now.